With just 5 days to go, we'll start today's BPR with emeritus Harvard Law Professor Alan Dershowitz. His book, Electile Dysfunction, A Guide for Unaroused Voters, which is virtually all of America. And the last of our final week reviews are the ballot questions. Today it's question 4, legalization of marijuana. We'll take your calls. Then at noon, it's Andrea Cabral. As tempers are rising in response to the police shooting of Terrence Coleman, Commissioner Evans says they had to meet force with force. Coleman's mother says he was unarmed.
A new study claims Boston's Uber drivers discriminate against African Americans. Its co-author joins us. A German reporter has traveled America for months. He'll tell us what his readers at home think of this lunatic race for the White House. Then Jim's favorite wine-a-thon will open the lines and ask you to help Jim, who will plead, please don't turn the clock back and make Jim drive home from work in the dark. Then Congressman Joe Kennedy joins us. All that coming up.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Hey there, Marjorie. You going to make it to Tuesday?
How many days?
Five days. And the long national nightmare is over.
Yes, touch and go, Jim. Touch and go.
We're going to have EMTs with you here in studio on Monday and Tuesday. Well, this presidential race has become an unpopularity contest, with 4 out of 5 Americans saying they're afraid of Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump winning the White House. And this fear, as Alan Dershowitz sees it, is leaving us feeling impotent. There's no blue pill to perk voters up, but the equivalent could be Alan Dershowitz's latest new book. It's called Electile Dysfunction, A Guide for the Unaroused Voter. He, of course, is an expert in constitutional and criminal law and an emeritus professor of law at Harvard Law School. Alan Dershowitz, great to talk to you.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on. Now, you know, voters are getting aroused as the election gets closer, but they're getting aroused negatively. They're hating the candidates even more than they were in the summer, and the campaign is getting even more negative, and now we're seeing threats of criminal charges against both candidates, and, you know, Hillary Clinton will be indicted and impeached, and Donald Trump will be audited and is going to be suing all of his accusers. It really sounds like a third world election, and now we have the FBI leaking material, which is a crime against the law, about ongoing elections. I mean, and Director Comey has mistaken himself for a play-by-play baseball announcer. Oh, the Indians have tied it up. Now let's see what the Cubs do. Let's give you play-by-play, every play, every play, every leak. You know, behind the scenes, he's the color commentator. He's the, you know, play-by-play. That's not the way criminal justice ought to operate in this country.
Nice to talk to you, Alan
Dershowitz. You did sum it up, not only in your great title, Electile Dysfunction, but in the chapter heading for your introduction, Everybody Sucks 2016 issue.
Well, chapter. The buttons that are being sold.
Yes.
You can get a shirt that says that. And, you know, it's a terrible thing when Americans don't want to vote for candidates. They just want to vote against candidates.
Yeah, but Alan Dershowitz, you're talking about current events. Let's go in reverse 12 months. Should America, should the parties, should the voters, should the media not have seen this coming with Clinton and Trump?
Of course they should have. You know, the voters get what they deserve. What's been really distorted and what I worry about for the future is the way the criminal justice system has been incorporated into elections. For 20 years, I've been railing against the criminalization of policy differences, whether by Republicans or Democrats. I stood behind Governor Perry and Tom DeLay, Republicans, when they were indicted for just doing things that everybody does politically. And I think the same thing is true now. Pay for play, is that new? My God, everybody understands that that's the way American politics works. We should change it. But the idea of investigating and indicting people because politics as usual just doesn't make a lot of sense.
Well, you talk a lot in your book, which is a great read, a very fast, great read. You talk a lot about the extremism that we're getting to on both sides, which seems to be a lot of what has gotten us into this mess, the kind of hysteria from both sides.
I think that's right, and we're seeing it around the world. We're seeing it in Eastern Europe, where the fascist right is rising again. We're seeing it in many universities and in England, where the Stalinist left is rising again. Repression. We don't want free speech. And I'm hoping, I was hoping this election would move us more to the center. We need to return to the vibrant center and have the debate classically between liberals and conservatives, not between the extreme right and the extreme left. And that's a trend that's going on around the world, and it's frightening.
Alan Dershowitz.
It produces populist candidates like Donald Trump.
You told a great anecdote about your grandson at the Harvard-Yale football game. Tell people about that.
Yeah, you know, my grandson is on the Harvard Lampoon, which is the Human magazine. He and a friend went to the Harvard-Yale football game, and the friend put up a sign and said, "Tackling is a microaggression." You know, a two on a scale of three in terms of good jokes. But the what they got in response, "You're terrible. You ought to be subjected to moral training. That's not funny. You're mocking our philosophy." Of course they're mocking it. That's what the Lampoon does. That's what humor is supposed to do. I have an article this month called "The Death of College Humor," which takes the issue even much further and shows that professors now terrified to use humor in the classroom or even in the lunchroom. And, you know, a pall has come over many universities because of this. You know, the most dangerous holiday in American universities now is Halloween. College administrators are terrified that some kid somewhere will use a costume that will offend somebody about something. And that's not the way you have open dialogue and discourse in a university.
A big mess at Yale. Can we return to FBI Director Comey for a second? A couple
sure.
of issues, Alan Dershowitz. I read something you wrote, I don't know, a week or, well, it had to be in the last week, because obviously it was in the wake of the second Comey announcement, the letter to Congress. You seem to be saying that he's got to try to, I don't know if you've used the word fix, he's got to do more. And
that's right.
With it, are you implying or saying outright that prior to next Tuesday, Comey should render a verdict in this thing?
No, but I think, for example, he has a computer program that will tell him whether or not these new emails are really duplicates of old emails. And if he finds out that's the case, he ought to say that. But at the very least, he ought to say the following. Look, when I made my announcement last Friday, I didn't know any more about the content of these emails than you do. I couldn't know whether they were pertinent or not, because the Fourth Amendment precludes FBI agents from looking at those emails unless and until they get a warrant, which they've just gotten now. So he has to make it clear that his statement to Congress, which was ill-advised, he never promised Congress he would tell them about the investigation. All he promised is that if new information came out, he would look into it, and he should look into it, of course. But he created the impression that he knew that there was something there. And I think he did it because he thought at that point Clinton was so far ahead of Trump that if Trump lost, he'd legitimately have a grievance if Comey didn't tell Congress that he had new information. But the opposite side of the coin, he apparently ignored. What if he turns the election against Hillary Clinton and she wins, she loses, and then it turns out there's nothing there, and he has to make an announcement 2 weeks from now saying, well, we've checked into it, they're all duplicates or they're all personal emails, there's nothing there. Sorry to have influenced the election. I'm going to go down in history as a villain, but I did my job.
I want to stay on
we
Comey.
We don't want that to happen either.
Let's stay on Comey. By the way, we're talking to Alan Dershowitz. Electile Dysfunction, A Guide for Unaroused Voters is his brand new book. Is it a Fourth Amendment problem if the FBI people who were looking at the emails, the original intent was to investigate this Anthony Weiner sexting mm-hmm. with this alleged sexting with this 15-year-old kid, who, by the way, said she felt abused by Comey. She and her father made a statement mm-hmm. in the last 24 hours. Is it a Fourth Amendment violation if what the FBI agents came upon, which is what led to Comey saying what he did to Congress, that they saw the headers innocently and inadvertently, which suggested that, in fact, there were Clinton Secretary of State-related emails in there? That's not a violation of the Fourth Amendment, is it?
Hard to see how it could be inadvertent, because the sexting investigation chronologically doesn't overlap with the emails that correspond to her being Secretary of State. But, of course, there is the doctrine of plain view, that if you are looking for something and it comes to your attention that there are headers, you then use that as a basis for going to court and getting a warrant. But they still don't know what's in the emails. And the implication, I thought, of Comey's statement initially was that he knows what's in the emails and there's something pertinent there, And that's why he's reopening the investigation, and that's why Donald Trump was able to say, this means she's going to be indicted. You know, obviously he's going to overstate the conclusion, but he led them to it. I just think that FBI directors, first of all, shouldn't say anything. Everything should be done by the Justice Department. FBI investigators are just FBI investigators. They're not prosecutors. Should have said nothing. And generally, the rules of the department are you just announce if there's an indictment or if the investigation is closed. You don't editorialize about, I think what she did was gross carelessness, or I'm reopening this and everything is pertinent. I just don't think that's the way you do it. Now that's encouraged leaks. We now have leaks today in the Wall Street Journal about high priority investigations of the Clinton Foundation. We shouldn't know about that until the investigation is complete.
Very quickly, though, I can't believe I'm even answering this question, but you led me down this path. Could a president-elect pardon a president-elect if he or she was charged with a crime?
No, that would be a conflict of interest. Of course, the current president, who would be a lame duck president, could pardon. The incoming president, of course, we know that that Ford pardoned Nixon. But I think if this is a hypothetical extreme, but I wrote about it in The Hill, if Hillary Clinton theoretically were to be indicted and as president were to pardon herself, she'd probably be impeached for doing that because it was a conflict of interest. That's what Nixon tried to do, basically, when he fired Archibald Cox. And look what happened as a result.
We're talking to Alan Dershowitz. The book is Electile Dysfunction. Alan, do you think that we're in this sort of situation where we're having this dysfunction and everything is terrible because the Republicans have nominated Donald Trump and the Democrats have nominated Hillary Clinton? Or is there something else afoot in the United States of America that's brought us to this mess?
I think both. I think the candidates brought it out more quickly, but I think we're moving in this country toward extremes and toward greater dysfunctionality in our political system with gridlock. We also have a systemic problem with our criminal justice system. We're among the only countries in the Western world that have merged the job of attorney general with the job of director of public prosecution. Every other country, there's a minister of justice that's a political appointee, like our attorney general is a political appointee. She's the president's advisor. She's a cabinet member. Then there's somebody completely different who decides on prosecution, a director of public prosecution, civil service, quasi-judicial job, not at all political. And that's what we should be doing in this country, because we're politicizing policy and political differences, and that is what banana republics do, and that's not what should happen in the United States.
You know, the turnaround on this book, I have to say, was about a minute and a half. But despite that fact, you wrote it when Gary Johnson had not humiliated himself twice on MSNBC.
Right.
You write, this should have been, and we said this on the show too, the all-time opening for a credible third-party candidate. Is the reason that, because everybody reviles the two candidates on the major parties, the reason it wasn't is because Gary Johnson has proved himself to be clueless and Jill Stein is just a retread. Is that not what happened here?
Well, I think Jill Stein is much worse than a retread. She's an evil person with evil views who would help, you know, really destroy America. That's why so few people are voting for her. Look, I think if the ticket of the Libertarians were flipped and if Bill Weld had gotten the presidential nomination, I think there'd be a strong, viable third party here. Bill Weld is a very credible guy who knows a great deal about foreign policy. And he's essentially now supporting Hillary Clinton.
He is.
So speaking of Hillary Clinton, Alan Dershowitz, despite our inability to get aroused in general about these candidates, you have conceded that not only are you aroused by Hillary Clinton, you don't think she's a liar. I believe you told this to Megyn Kelly. So why do you see what a lot of Americans don't see in terms of her candidacy?
Well, I know her well. I've known her for many years. I can only judge her based on my experience with her, my wife's experience with her. We're friends from Martha's Vineyard. We used to see each other socially when they came to the Vineyard a lot. I just never saw the person that is being caricatured by the media, and mostly not by the media, mostly by Donald Trump. I just don't see that. And I'm disturbed by some of the evidence, though, but it's not the Hillary Clinton that I know, and I'm not going to use words like liar to describe somebody who I've never had an experience with her telling a lie. She's been extremely truthful, candid, and straightforward in her interactions with me and my family.
Do you think this is because she's a woman and we've not elected a woman?
I think populists only can be men. I have a chapter in my book, Electoral Dysfunction, about that. to be a populist, you have to be a man, because populists brag about their sex lives. They talk about all kinds of things that no woman can talk about. We expect our, quote, women to be ladies.
Yeah.
We expect them all to be like Margaret Thatcher and, Golda Meir and Angela Merkel. But, you know, boys will be boys. Hey, so Bill Clinton, you know, does this or that, and Donald Trump does this or that. We do have clearly a double standard in how we judge candidates based on their gender.
You know, Alan Dershowitz, I didn't see the Megyn Kelly interview that Marjorie just referred to where you said you don't think mm-hmm. she's a liar. You mentioned your personal dealings. I hate using the word lie, so I won't. But you would acknowledge that her public representations were refuted by James Comey when testifying in front of that congressional committee. There were a whole bunch of representations she made about the emails, from the number of devices to not having either sent or received items marked classified to the number, you know, turning over all the business-related emails. Mm-hmm. All of that was untrue.
Well, it turns out that it was untrue, but the question of lying is whether or not she had an intention to deceive, take the issue of classification. Nothing was marked classified. Three of them had little C's, and she said, and I absolutely believe her, that she had no idea that a small C meant confidential. It doesn't mean classified. It means confidential in a document that isn't marked classified. So I can easily understand how the truth would be different from what she said without characterizing what she said as a lie.
Do you know Trump, by the way?
I've met him on a couple of occasions. Okay. I don't know him well, and I liked him when I met him. He seemed like a very decent, reasonable, responsible guy. I don't recognize him either from the Donald Trump who I met several years ago.
You know, the most important issue in this studio, and I bet it's high on your list, it's in your little checklist of where the candidates stand on a bunch of things at the end of your book, which is actually very useful, I should say.
It is.
Is the Supreme Court. I mean, other than war to us, and I guess I'm hoping to you, there's nothing more important. You say, if you want more Sotomayors, Hillary Clinton is your person. If you want more Scalia's, Trump is your person. One of the things that concerns me, in light of the fact, as you note, that that at least three of the liberals are in their late 70s or 80s, the oldest of which, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, I guess, in her 80s and has had some health issues through recent years. Do you entertain the notion that some sort of term limit might be a good thing? The thing that bothers me, and I assume this is not an original thought, if the next president picks somebody, how old was Roberts when he was picked? 45, 47, whatever
he was?
Very
young, in his late 40s. Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
So they serve through 10 presidential terms if they're in good health. Isn't there something wrong with that?
There is. I mean, framers had in mind people living to 45 or 50, so a life term was 10 years. Now we're going to get younger and younger justices, and they're going to live longer and longer. And if, by the way, the Senate, Republican-controlled Senate, refuses to confirm any nominees, you're going to get nobody quitting. You're going to get justices serving into their 90s. I just saw it, Justice Stevens was rooting for the Cubs and was at the stadium. I think he's 96 years old. If he knew that he was not going to be replaced and that the seat would remain vacant, he would still be sitting on the Supreme Court today at the age of 96. So we're going to see a lot of very old justices if the Republicans refuse to confirm any of Hillary Clinton's nominees if she is to be elected president.
Should she renominate Merrick Garland if she's elected president?
She could, and she doesn't have to renominate
him. I know, but
him.
Should she? Oh, but should she?
Oh, I think she should. Oh, definitely.
Why?
I think she should. I think he is a centrist liberal, the best that she's going to get through the Senate. I think he's a very distinguished jurist, and I think if the Republicans were to confirm him, that would send a powerful message to Hillary Clinton. If you nominate centrists, we'll let them through, but if you pick people who are ideologically extreme, we're not going to let them through. So I think that it would be the best for everybody if his nomination after the election were to be approved by the Republican-controlled Senate, because the Senate will still be Republican-controlled the next few months, even if the Democrats win, because they don't take office until the new year.
You know, Alan Dershowitz, when I was young and idealistic, I used to think in the United States of America that when push came to shove, we'd eventually do the right thing. Now that I'm not young anymore, I don't think that. And I use a kind of an example of the fact that the roads and bridges and airports and the infrastructure of the United States is falling apart, and we can't even agree to fix it and spend the money to fix it anymore. And I get depressed about that. How do we?
No,
get
you should. You should get depressed.
Well, what do you see as the future or a way out of this mess? Or is this just the way it's going to be?
Elizabeth Cantor has written a brilliant book on infrastructure.
Yes, she has.
We really have to take and pay close attention to the infrastructure. But, you know, gridlock affects everything. It affects even whether or not we build new airports or new roads or new bridges. And, you know, the framers of our Constitution did not write a Constitution for its efficiency. Our system of tripartite government checks and balances is designed to prevent tyranny, not designed to create efficiency. But now it's become, if anything, too inefficient, and gridlock has become a kind of permanent default position in our politics, and it's going to really hurt the country. It's going to hurt us competitively with the rest of the world. And, I mean, look at even two recent examples. You get the president, in order to get the Iran treaty, which I was not in favor of, but in order to get it enacted, he has to ignore the Senate, ignore the House, ignore the will of the people, and push it through just as an executive order. And now that the president will have a period of lame duck of 2 months, he's going to also try to push things through about the getting the Israel issue to the United Nations. So the only time presidents can basically do anything is if they act alone. And that's not what the framers of our Constitution intended.
We're talking to Alan Dershowitz. I'm looking down at your book and one of the blurbs on the cover, Larry David, this book is so good, I might even finish it. Alan, before you leave, so we all agree it's a mess. How do we ensure that you don't write Electile Dysfunction, the sequel, in 4 years? I don't mean rhetorically that we get people more in the middle. In the real world that passes the laugh test, what has to happen post-late January for this not to repeat itself 4 years down the line?
Well, I think the Republicans, it depends. If the Republicans lose this election badly, they will restructure the nominating process. I think we have to restructure the nominating process because our nominations, particularly the Republicans, because they don't have superdelegates, can tend to get extremist and populist candidates. They will probably move more to the Democratic Party's approach. The interesting thing is the Republicans are more, quote, Democrat with a small D than the Democrats are, because they do allow the results to be a reflection of the primaries. Second, the primary should all be on the same day. We shouldn't have, you know, Iowa having so much influence and so many candidates being dropped from running early on because they didn't do well in two or three states that don't have any general impact on the election. So I think there are some structural things we can do, but I have a suspicion that I may be writing the sequel to this book in 4 years. So stay tuned. I think this is a more systemic problem than just the two candidates.
Alan, thanks for your time. That was great.
Thank you very much. Congratulations on another terrific book. And this is a fast read, and it's really fun. Alan, thank you for taking the time. Alan Dershowitz is an expert in constitutional and criminal law and an emeritus professor of law at Harvard Law School. The book, Electile Dysfunction, A Guide for the Unaroused Voter. Coming up, we're opening up the lines, continuing our ballot question discussion, that is, asking you about ballot question number 4. Should recreational marijuana be legalized?
You have to help Marjorie because she hasn't made up her mind yet either, so we really need you to call in.
This is my cause celeb. Yeah. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Before we get to the ballot question, we're going to discuss question 4 in a second here. I don't usually check the emails during the show, but I do.
I do.
I know you do. I do. Here is one from CS. Jim, you are seriously deranged. You are the king of false equivalency. You are blinded by your hatred for Hillary as you were 9 years ago. You have become impossible to listen to. Okay. Then I just check one of my personal emails. Jim, I watched your TV show last night. Your contempt for Trump runs so deep, I'm considering reporting you to the Secret Service. That's why this job is as great as it is.
Yeah, I know. I think it's very partisan.
Oh, you think so?
I think it's very partisan.
So
yeah.
This week, we've been revisiting the ballot questions one final time. Today, we're wrapping things up, asking you about question 4, which, as you know, proposes a change of the state's marijuana laws. Massachusetts decriminalized possession of marijuana, almost 2-1, actually, in 2008, and by a roughly similar margin, legalized medical marijuana in 2012. If passed, question number 4 would legalize recreational marijuana. Here, We're among a handful of states, including California, that are voting on it on November
8th.
And Maine, that's right. Already four states plus D.C. have legalized recreational marijuana. Latest polling, you don't know, finds that 55% of likely support for legalization here. Are you among them, or are you concerned about this being a gateway drug? Do you think the state has the infrastructure to effectively regulate and oversee a new industry? And in light of the fact that Marjorie is totally in the tank.
I am in the tank.
On this, in the spirit of fairness.
Or you could say in the bong.
Exactly.
Or I want to be in the bong.
In the spirit of fairness, later in the show, actually the end of the show, we'll have Congressman Joe Kennedy. He's an opponent, and so we'll get to talk to him about it too. But now's your chance. 877-301-8970. Where are you on question four? How are you planning to vote? Why are you planning to vote the way you are? And you know what I didn't notice this morning? The proponents here have a lot more money than the opponents.
Yep.
Which is good news for you. I would argue bad news for democracy, because the history in this state is that if one side seriously outspends the other, almost always the larger spending side wins the battle.
Well, there's a huge incentive for spending that money because there's a lot of business to be made. And that's why I think it's so great that Ayanna Pressley at the Boston City Council is making the pitch. And she's absolutely right that there should be more opportunity in the African-American community to get a piece of this action and not to be so restrictive about who can open marijuana stores and saying that people that may have had a brush with marijuana in their youth should be disqualified, or people that have had minor records in their youth should be disqualified. I think she's absolutely right about that. It shouldn't just be these big, huge businesses.
Well, also, if it weren't for this ridiculous federal law or regulation, whatever you want to call it, which considers it to be a Schedule One drug like heroin, and I assume even people against legalization think that's a bit much, and the
you
DA was supposed to be revisiting it, then if this were to pass, it could be like liquor stores. I mean, it could be a similar sort of thing, so you wouldn't have to go through all this rigmarole. In any case, our number is 877-301-8970. How are you voting on this? And
would you like to say where you are on these ballot questions,
Marjorie,
or are you trying to maintain
the
your
difference between you and me on both the presidential race and question four and question two? Is I am a professional.
Oh, okay.
You're free to disclose your
biases.
Biases.
I was a columnist for 25 years.
You were,
it's hard to get myself out of the opinion business when I've been in the opinion business for most of my life.
Okay, but I'm not going to tell you how I'm going to vote, because I don't want to lose more viewers and listeners like apparently I'm doing by the minute based on these emails. I've said this to you before. I don't know, maybe 2 or 3 or 4 years ago, we were talking about the legalization of marijuana, even though this question was not on the ballot. Maybe it was during medical marijuana. And I said, you know, it's amazing how weak and scared so many elected officials are, because you got to believe at least some think this is a good idea besides Gary Johnson. And I said, I bet the only person in Congress who has the courage to say we should legalize marijuana is Rand Paul, or Ron Paul at that time. I'm not sure. Do you remember who called us cold on the phone?
Nope.
A particular person called and said, you actually left one person out who supports legalization of marijuana.
Oh, Seth Moulton does.
No, that was not. He was not a congressman then. There was Barney Frank, who called into our show. And my position on these issues is generally, even though I listen
to
Barney
had a run-in. Wasn't one of his friends growing pot in the backyard?
I don't remember.
Or like
all that? I do know is the position is, if you're not hurting anybody else with your behavior, he has that libertarian side of him controls, and it generally does with me too.
Well, the only politician I'll let off the hook on this is someone who is in recovery, like Marty Walsh.
Marty Walsh, yeah.
Because I think one of the problems, and Joe Kennedy is going to have the same position because of his family's issues with
alcohol. Well, you don't know
alcohol.
You don't know if that's what it is. Do
well,
you know that's
why
it is?
Oh,
he has.
Before.
Oh, I'm sorry. I didn't know
that.
Yeah,
he talked about the great work his cousin Patrick Kennedy has done, these kinds of things. The people that have addiction problems, I think, have a difficulty seeing anything good about drugs, because happily the vast majority,
or anything not bad about drugs,
right? Happily the vast majority of people are not alcoholics. Happily the vast majority of people are not marijuana potheads. Opioids obviously is a much different problem. That's where you have a very high addiction rate. But you don't with liquor, and you don't with marijuana. To me, this is all about personal freedom. It's no different than liquor.
Well, that's what I was trying to say about the
Barney
Frank thing.
Is a wonderful thing? Are there problems with it? Yes, there are. Are there problems with alcohol? Yes, there are. But this is none of the government's business. And to be arresting people about it and having helicopters and National Guardsmen and state troopers terrorize 80-year-olds because they're growing a pot plant in their backyard.
Which has happened in Massachusetts. If you read Marjorie's great
Amherst,
column in the Boston
right.
Globe.
And it happened in Martha's Vineyard. And it happened to this couple in Wendell, if I'm pronouncing that
know.
Little town correctly,
it, yeah.
who even had a medical marijuana license. It's the war on drugs. It's failed on every drug, but it's particularly failed on these drugs like marijuana that are not hugely addictive drugs.
877-301-8970. So you can hear, as you can hear, Marjorie is undecided.
Yep.
And
I am.
She'd
well,
like to hear from
selfish,
listeners.
It's a selfish kind of thing. Like I've said before, I've said it to the police commissioner, I've said it to the governor.
Enough.
Had one of those rookie cookies out in Colorado.
Okay,
in my old age, I'd love to be able to sit in my rocking chair and have another one.
You know what they should do here in Massachusetts?
What?
The legislature, even if the packaging is better out there, as Andrew Friedman explained to us the other day,
yeah.
making a you know, do you remember Danielle Moralia, who's that terrific singer? She's been in
yep.
our studio. She
yep.
and her band are performing.
Yep.
She tweeted the other day after this conversation, you know, the problem with those edibles is they look attractive to kids. She said, why don't you make them look like, package them like asparagus or spinach?
Exactly.
And then you won't have to worry.
You don't want to ban the edibles, Jim.
No, but can I tell you, if it turns out that's such a serious concern, and even the governor, Hickenlooper, who has essentially changed his position out there in Colorado, mm-hmm. says we're learning on the fly. I think the quote was out there, we're flying an airplane that we're still building as we go.
Yeah.
Then deal with implementing this thing in a fair way. We've had so many problems with so much implementation here, including medical marijuana. I think we could do without edibles. I know that would upset you in the short term, but they would be legalized by
yeah,
the ballot question.
Here's why you don't want to do without edibles, because a lot of people do not want to be smoking anything. They don't want to do that.
Well, that's a decent point.
And the edibles are can help people with different sort of ailments. As you see when you go to the medical marijuana places now, there's a million different varieties. There's oils. There's all these kinds of things. So to ban edibles, because Jim, we just talked about the other day about this, a nip of Smirnoff vodka was in somebody's Halloween
bag.
That's
one thing. Talk
exactly,
about an outlier.
Exactly. But the outliers are in Colorado in terms of kids taking these edibles, and the numbers are decreasing.
877-301-8970. So it's your turn, Fred. You're in Derry, New Hampshire. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hey there.
Hey, before I make my point, I just want to mention, I think Jim has a felt painting of a Trump sign. He watches the black light at night. Just saying.
I am never giving up my black light, Fred. I want to be clear. For those who don't know what it is, go Google it. Go ahead, Fred.
I haven't smoked pot in 18 years, but who's counting? You know, it was a daily job for me. Yeah, I'm a recovering addict. But if I was living in New Hampshire still, in Mass still, I would vote yes for this measure.
Why?
For a number of reasons, including it criminalizes otherwise law-abiding citizens.
Yeah.
It also disproportionately targets black communities.
Yes, it does. Even though the usage rates are roughly equal between whites and communities of color. But go ahead.
Yes. Many reasons. By the way, my point, though, is that I want to let other people talk, is that, yes, of most people who try pot, it's a recreation. It is, you do it on vacation or once in a moon. However, for 6 to 10% of people, there will become a daily compulsion. In other words, it stops being fun. There's a daily need to use
yeah.
it. It's clinically, you know.
So where do you go with that?
An addiction. So I'd like to have some funding for the predictable number of people who are stuck with a problem they're trying to get rid of.
It's in the question. It's
yeah, can
in
you
the
guys
question.
Check on that, by
That's
the way?
That's part of it, just like with the gambling thing. Thank you for the call,
thank you, Fred.
But just like with the gambling thing, a big portion of the
I don't know
gambling,
how big. Do you know? Our colleagues are going to check it out in the middle.
Well, in the gambling, there's a lot of help for people with gambling addictions.
Yeah.
In fact, one of the things that's great in the casinos, which I think is terrific, is they have people right there as you're
mm-hmm.
exiting the casino. So
if
you blew your paycheck that week and you're feeling horrible and you're walking out of the casino, there's someone you can walk
right up
to
give
and
you
say,
a cigarette.
I've got a gambling problem.
Dan, you're
they
in Worcester.
Don't give you a cigarette.
Oh, they don't?
No, they don't. There's no smoking in the casinos.
Sorry. Dan in Worcester, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Welcome, Dan. How are you?
Good morning, Matthew and Jim. How are you guys doing today?
We're good. Thank you.
Great. I am reluctantly going to vote yes for the passage of this bill. And I'll tell you, I think it's the only reason why is the practical standpoint of the taxation part of it. Because we have this drug People are using it in great numbers. And you know, you're locking people up for this misdemeanor that I think it is. And we don't need to go through all those machinations. But my only thing is, my point on all of this is it's not that, in my opinion, it's not the drug itself. It's the mindset. That's where the problem is. It's going to put young people into another mindset. Now, we have an alcohol mindset, which, okay, you know, it's legal and all that stuff. And people, when you're, you know, just like all of us when we were teenagers, we had somebody buying us our beer to gut the whole thing down. And it's the same thing, that mindset is going to creep into our society now. And kids are going to feel that they will be able to when they're underage.
Dan, it's in our mindset now. When Seth Moulton, either on the phone or in person, told us that he was voting yes on this, his response to that issue was they're already using it, and regulating it is a far better way to attempt to address the problem than not regulating it. So, I hear you. And by the way, to allay one concern, there are not a lot of arrests going on in Massachusetts. However, the situations Marjorie described, that 80-some-year-old woman, Peg Holcomb, where the helicopter flies over her house and National Guards people and state police descend on her house to cut down one marijuana plant, gives you a sign of things that shouldn't come. But Dan, thank you for the call.
But the thing that happens, and this is what Tito Jackson, the Boston City Council, has talked about, Michelle Wu in the City Council, and the guy from the ACLU, I forget his name, that we had in
Rahsaan
here.
Hall.
Thank you. Rahsaan Hall talked about that the marijuana can become a gateway to arresting you if you are a black kid. You know, you may not get arrested for, they come by your car and they see half a joint in there, but suddenly it's an excuse to look at other things you may be doing, and that would not happen. Michelle Wu's great point, and she's a Harvard graduate. And she points out that it's really weird that you can be smoking up a storm at Harvard or at Stanford or wherever you went to college, these highfalutin colleges. But if you're doing the same thing in Dudley Square, you get in lots of trouble. And there's
imbalance.
Imbalance. Thank you very much.
Frank and Stowe, you're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call. Hi, Frank.
Hi, folks. I just want to say first, I love your show.
Thanks.
I listen to it every day.
Thank you.
I have been smoking for over 50 years,
oy,
both cigarettes and marijuana,
and
I'm 73 years old, and I think without a doubt that people should really, enough government interference, let the people do what they want. You know, you sit back, you relax, you either take a joint or a beer, what the hell, you know, use the money, get it away from the black market, use the money to go for infrastructure.
Well,
now,
you know,
Frank, I want to know a couple questions here. Do you feel that you can still remember who your neighbors are? Do you have short-term memory problems? How has this 50 years of smoking pot affected you?
No, I don't see any problems at all with it, you know, as long as you don't, you know, abuse it. I haven't had any problems, short memory, long-term memory, maybe at the time when I smoke, but, you know, after that, it's over.
Good. Okay, just checking, because anticipation of this thing being legal, you know, I don't want to lose my mind.
Frank, thank you for your call, and Marjorie, thanks you for your vote. 877-301-8970. I have a sense, regardless of where people are, this is one of these things where you're going to look back and we are going to look back and say, I can't believe we are spending millions of dollars fighting over this. Alcohol is legal. Legalize it. Be as careful as one possibly can. Get government out of the business of policing this, I should say, meaning that law enforcement kind of thing, and move on to stuff that is more important.
The strongest argument on the other side, I think, is about intoxicated on marijuana driving. And
and the fatality rate has gone up pretty significantly in Washington State, but you have a response to that.
As people may know, certainly the gentleman that just called me smoking marijuana for 50 years knows that marijuana stays in your system for a long time.
So you don't know if you're right.
You don't know if you are driving stoned at that moment. Now, supposedly there are tests that can show what's in your system, and they're getting more sophisticated and stuff, but you may have smoked the marijuana 3 weeks before. But the point I was going to make from the other side is you could have just smoked it, and you shouldn't be driving a car, obviously, if you are high.
Of course you should.
So there needs to be better methods to determine whether you are driving stoned, and that's the strongest argument on the other side, but that's really about the only one I can think of. We are talking about question number 4 and our continuing debate up to Election Day on the ballot questions, and that, of course, is whether or not you want to legalize marijuana. We're going to keep talking about it next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, we're talking about ballot question four, which proposes legalizing recreational marijuana in Massachusetts. California, Maine, a couple of other states will be voting on the same day. And by the way, if California passes it, obviously, the number of people who live in states where marijuana is legal will jump exponentially. The question is this: should Marjorie be able to lawfully take hits on her big bong when she retires, or should she risk having the state police paratroop down onto her front porch? I never thought about that. Someday you're going to be an 80-something-year-old like Peg Holcomb and Amherst.
Exactly.
And you're going to be growing a pot plant in your backyard.
God, I hope so.
And whatever. 877-301-8970. Which side are you on and why?
Robert just emailed and said, Barney Frank. Remember, he was sitting on the front porch, and he thinks it was up in Maine. It was someplace, and they came because one of his buddies was growing pot in the yard. Yeah, they did not arrest Barney.
No, that's a good use of police resources, wouldn't you say?
I think so. I think, you know, Barney Frank, he's an outlaw.
Yeah, really. 877-301-8970. Let's go to Jack in Worcester. Hi, Jack.
Hey, Jim, Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My point is something that hasn't been brought up. It's a bit of a selfish one. I'm a cancer patient, part of the medical program in Massachusetts. But being in Worcester, you got to drive an hour to get to a dispensary at this point.
Is that true?
Pain. Yeah, there's Brookline and Northampton is like the closest.
Wait, is there nothing in Worcester? Is nothing in Worcester County? Was there not a mandate? And I'm Barry, you would know this better than that. Was there not a mandate that there be at least one dispensary in each of the counties, or am I wrong?
I don't know anything about it.
We're going to check that too, by the way.
One Worcester County.
Okay.
Sure.
Go ahead, Jack. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
And part of the part of legalization, recreational legalization, is it drops the price for medical patients. Right now,
it's
medical
expensive.
Patients, like, they pay black market prices.
Yeah.
I don't pay anything less than what I would pay to the guy down the road that I used to get it from before I became a patient. I like to do it because it's in compliance. It doesn't support a black market, but it drops the price almost in half. And the price, if you're an actual legit patient going through chemo or whatever your situation is, it gets very costly to keep your medication if you don't want to be on the opiates or any of the other things.
Yeah, that is a really good point that I have not heard before, Jack.
It's a great point. And you know, the point was made by both the gentleman in Edgartown that was raided by the cops because his wife was dying of cancer and he was growing marijuana for her so he wouldn't have to pay these prices. And the same reason was given by Peg Holcomb, the woman from Amherst. That you're absolutely right. The medical marijuana is expensive. And it's really kind of disgraceful because when you see these testimonies from people in there, including like you, cancer patients, Jack, one of the things that was so moving to me is that many people say how they hate being on these opioids because their brain is in a fog all day long and how the marijuana had freed them from that sort of zombie-like life.
Sure, and just anxiety of having one of these issues, having cancer and worrying about it, it helps for those things, too. And
yeah.
A totally separate point, the man you had on from the ACLU, I think it was last week when you were debating it, what he kind of was trying to say, but I don't think he wanted to say it, is when they say it's decriminalized and people aren't being arrested for it, people who are being arrested for it disproportionately are people who have more than an ounce, who are drug dealers.
Mm-hmm.
And those tend to be people from, you know, from areas that are, you know, their opportunities aren't as high. And that's why the African Americans are disproportionately affected by it, because those are the, you know, I don't want to pick brush, but those are the people who get arrested, are people with more than mounts and you know.
Got it.
That's how that
goes.
Jack, the connection's bad. We got to let you go. Good luck to you, by the way. Thanks
for
the call.
I agree with you, Jack, on that one, because I think that there's a lot of drug dealing going on at a lot of very fancy, snancy colleges, and the drug dealers are not poor black kids from the hood. They're rich white kids that are making a lot of money in fancy colleges selling drugs.
877-301-8970. Where do we go next?
Cindy from Providence. Hi, Cindy.
Hello, Cindy.
Hi, how are you?
We're good.
Fine, thanks.
Great. Listen, first of all, I love your show. I listen to it every day.
Thank you very much.
I'm in my 60s. I used to smoke pot in my youth. And then I stopped. I did a couple of jobs where you couldn't smoke pot and all of that. But I had an injury, and now I'm left with neuropathy. And my choice was to get a medical marijuana card because I did not want to get into that opioid sort of headspace and routine. I prefer to eat edibles. I don't smoke pot. And it certainly helps with alleviating the focus on my pain. It doesn't take the pain away. But it stops my obsession and it adds to my relaxation. So I'm in favor of it, and people should wake up.
Yeah, Cindy, thank you very much for sharing your story.
You know, that reminds me of the insomnia thing. A lot of women over 40 have terrible insomnia problems. And one of my dearest friends who lives in California, where medical marijuana is legal, her mother died from emphysema. She is, you know, vehemently opposed to smoking anything. But she gets the, I don't know what she gets, but she makes cookies from whatever it is that she buys at the store. And she eats them 2 hours before she wants to go to sleep. And they've cured her insomnia problems.
By the way, that wife, that a guy you mentioned on the Cape, the other octogenarian whose house was raided with a helicopter and whatever, was making tea out
for
of it
wife.
For his wife who had pancreatic cancer.
Yeah.
And also, if I believe, he was also making, was he the one who was a Peg Holcomb? I can't remember who we interviewed, was making it available to neighbors. Not, they weren't charging anything, but neighbors who couldn't get to a dispensary or needed it for some medical reason.
I'm not sure.
They were doing that sort of thing.
Mark in the car. Thank you for calling, Mark.
Hi, Mark.
Hi. So I guess I want to start off by saying that I currently do not smoke pot. I'm a PhD student looking for internships and jobs and stuff. So, I'm not doing that now, but, you know, in my younger years, all through high school and college, I was definitely a regular pot smoker. And I guess my point being that when I was in high school, when I was 16 years old, it was so hard to find somebody over 21 to go buy us alcohol. But it was so easy to find weed from another 16-year-old at my school.
Oh. Yeah.
So for all those, like, moms out there who are nervous about this getting into the hands of kids, I think legalizing it and giving it an actual age will be way harder for people, for kids to get it in their hands.
Yeah, you know, Mark, I've heard that so many times from teenagers, including my own children, who said the same thing. You can get it at 5 minutes at school, and you have to get someone to buy you the liquor, or you have to steal it from your parents.
And I have to say, Mark, thank you for your call. One of the things I never criticize you on air unless I have to. Mm-hmm. The days I've driven through Brookline and see you standing outside schools when your kids graduated years ago. It's really,
it's
such a dead giveaway, Marjorie.
You know, I want to be able to hold my head up high and go right in and not have to go, you know, to Brookline High School. I'm joking, of course, with a bag over my head. I would not do that. And that's the thing when Jason Lewis says that this is not about law-abiding grown-ups smoking marijuana or eating edibles. It is, because, of course, it's illegal to buy marijuana. And it's, you can't. If you're an honest person, you don't want to lie about a medical condition to get down to the medical dispensary. So it is about law-abiding citizens. That's what my column in the Globe was about, which I will shamelessly
promote
right now. Countering, you know, anti-pot hysterics, get rid of the reefer madness, was saying this is about older people too.
You know, I mentioned a minute ago, I think it was Jack from Worcester, who's a cancer survivor, and who is mentioning that there's no dispensary in Worcester County, to his knowledge. The law, I was right for once. The law does require there be at least one dispensary per county. And it's, I'm guessing that what has happened is the reality is not caught up with the mandate, because remember how bad the rollout was. Next time the governor joins us, I think it's in late November, we will ask him about what the state of getting them in compliance with the law, the per county
because
thing. What's the state?
There's a big, huge fight when they want to open these medical marijuana dispensaries, and there will be huge fights if this does pass, opening the legal ones too.
But this guy with cancer has to drive an hour.
I mean, it's terrible.
That is unconscionable.
And again, when you go to these dispensaries, they are really impressive. I mean, I went to the one in Brookline, and I went to ones in Colorado, the legal ones. And they're really quite impressive, too.
877-301-8970. And also, in all fairness to Marjorie, if Donald Trump ends up winning the presidency, Marjorie's going to need question four.
I am.
So
it's true.
Maybe you want to throw her a bone.
Think of me.
Vote yes.
On voting day. That's right. John from Rhode Island. Hi, John.
Hello, John.
How you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for calling.
I'm a kid. I listen to your show every now and then when I'm in town, and I'm an over-the-road driver, and I'm also a caregiver in Rhode Island.
Oh, you are.
I have patients, and I grow, and I've taken care of a lot of cancer patients, and it's helped a lot of people. I've got one woman who tried to kill herself four times a couple years ago, who now couldn't walk without a walker or a cane or anything, now walks without her cane or walker because she's been smoking the different stuff. She also likes the edibles. And
wow.
The edibles and stuff, I know it's a contradiction. The thing is, it should be treated like alcohol. You know what I mean? It should be given to kids, obviously. And it's going to be given to them in moderation. You know, it's going to be explained to different people, like the cookies and stuff like that. It's a slow thing. It takes 45 minutes for them to kick in. You know, I've got another woman who's a nurse. who had 13 brain surgeries, who was on morphine, all kinds of pills, this and that. She can't sleep at night unless she has an edible cookie and relaxes at nighttime.
Well,
you know, I mean, it's not a lot. We've got actually dogs that do, we do dog cookies. Very little bit of THC. The CBDs help the patients too, but I got dogs with arthritis.
That is unbelievable.
You're kidding.
No, I'm not. I got a 16-year-old pit bull, and she gets a little bit of a tiny cookie, and it's been reduced real a lot, so it's not like she's tripping.
Got
the thing
it.
Is, she can actually walk and run around the backyard. You would think this 16-year-old was a 2-year-old dog again.
John,
my God,
you're a good soul, John. Thank you for the call.
This could be a new bonding opportunity for me and Harry the Peanut.
The two of you walking on the streets of Brookline.
But you know what else I learned that I did not know?
No, I did not.
That there's,
I do not.
That there's all sorts of different kinds of marijuana. There's the up energetic marijuana and the down sleepy marijuana. I did not know that.
You learned that from Colorado, I assume,
I learned that from Colorado, and I learned it again when I went to the Brookline dispensary, that people, they mix it to fit. It's like a prescription for the kind that you want. So if you're someone that needs it for sleeping, obviously you want to get the down marijuana.
I want to take back what I said about the edibles. In light of these calls and what you said, I was wrong, actually, 20 minutes ago or 30. And I was. I mean, I was. There should not be. The legislature should. I mean, it doesn't mean they shouldn't fix this thing. One of the things, I mean, one of the amazing things, you remember about a week ago, while Charlie Baker is adamantly opposed to this and he's made clear to us repeatedly.
Well, since he confessed he smoked weed
but
at Harvard University.
Karen Polito, his lieutenant governor, joins Bob D'Elia, who also opposes it, the speaker, and Stan Rosenberg, who told us that he's voting yes, to talk about how, if it passes, they're probably going to raise the tax because the tax is not adequate. And as I've said to the governor repeatedly here, the Beacon Hill should tell the public all the things they're contemplating doing to fix, to amend this thing if it becomes law, so people are on notice. But apparently the tax is one of the things that will go up.
Well, I think politicians, like I said, are very nervous about any kind of indication that they're in favor of any kind of drug.
What kind of blowback are you going to get in Massachusetts in 2016?
Seth Moulton. He's daring enough to say he is. A million years ago, I loved Joe Malone. He used to be the former treasurer when it was you could really get in trouble for saying you smoked pot. Everybody else said, oh, I had it. I didn't inhale. Oh, I didn't like it. I didn't. Or Bill Clinton, you know. Joe Malone said, yeah, I did it at Harvard, and it was pretty fun.
Yeah, but you know what happened to him as a result of it?
What?
He's a big Trump supporter. Do you know that?
Well, you know, maybe he had
one
toke too many.
Sure, okay.
Okay, up next, fatal shootings of police officers are up more than 50% from last year. Suffolk County Sheriff Andrew Cabral joins us for that and more. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
At noon on today's Boston Public Radio, it's Andrew Cabral. As tempers are rising in response to the police shooting of Terrence Coleman, Commissioner Evans says they had to meet force with force. Coleman's mother says he was unarmed. We'll find out what the former Secretary of Public Safety says.
A new study claims Boston Uber drivers discriminate against African Americans. The co-author of that study joins us. A German reporter has traveled America for months, and we'll ask him what his readers back home think of this lunatic race for the White House. We'll open the lines for Jim's favorite fall wine-a-thon. Please don't turn the clock back and make Jim have to drive home from work in the dark. He just can't take it. Then Congressman Joe Kennedy will join us. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Eakin. You're listening to hour number two of Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Hello again, Jim.
I also want to say, I don't think we've said this today, we're at the library tomorrow.
We are at the library tomorrow. I'm very excited.
Now doing virtually all Fridays at the Boston Public Library,
right,
the Copley branch. So we'd love you to join us between 11 and 2. Not only get to see us, we can talk to you, that sort of thing. Get to see a radio show, the Newsfeed Cafe, which is spectacular.
I'm washing my hair,
space with us,
planning my outfit.
Oh, my goodness. In any case, could Ubering while black be the new driving while black? A new study finds that the ride-sharing program has its fair share of racial discrimination. In Boston, drivers for Uber canceled rides for those with black-sounding names more than twice as often as those with white-sounding names. Study came out of MIT, Stanford, and the University of Washington. We're joined by one of the authors, Christopher Knittel. Chris is a William Barton Rogers Professor of Energy Economics in the Sloan School of Management and the Director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy Research at MIT. Chris, good to meet you. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming in, Chris. So tell us what you did and why you did it.
Sure. So we ran two actual randomized controlled experiments, one in Seattle and one in Boston. And what we did in Seattle is we had 8 research assistants go out and hail Uber and Lyft rides, 4 of whom were black and 4 white. And then in Boston, we changed it slightly where we had the same research assistant have 2 actual accounts for Lyft and Uber. One account was tied to a more stereotypically white-sounding name, and one account was tied to a stereotypical black-sounding
name. What were the
names? Like Allison versus Aisha, okay, or Jamal versus Jerry.
Okay.
Why'd you do this to begin with?
Well, these services provide the potential to reduce a lot of discrimination. Historically, we've seen certainly anecdotal evidence and some research on discrimination in the traditional taxicab industry. And we wanted to see whether there was any evidence among the shared economy, whether it was there as well.
And I stated in really rough fashion what your conclusion was. Why don't you state it more precisely? What did you find in Boston vis-a-vis Uber and Lyft?
So in Boston, what we find is exactly what you said, which is if a research assistant is using a black-sounding name, the probability that an Uber driver accepts the ride and sees the name and then immediately cancels more than doubles. With Lyft, they don't have to cancel because actually Lyft drivers see the name before they accept.
So they may be as guilty of discrimination as the Uber drivers. They just have a different system.
They can do it in a way that we would never pick up with the data.
You know, Chris, the language I think I pulled from the report, actually I didn't read the report, I read the stories about the report, said significant evidence of racial discrimination. But in one of the stories in Massachusetts I read, one of your West Coast colleagues said, and this is a paraphrase, blame the driver, not Uber. Is that where you all end up, is that where you end up?
Well, it's certainly the case, and a lot's been made of this, that the drivers are independent contractors. So Uber and Lyft are beholden to what the behavior of the driver. But what we do say in the report is that there are ways that they can adjust their app and adjust their system to reduce this sort of discrimination.
But I see my reaction to that when I heard your colleague again saying, and again, he didn't use the terms blame the driver, but it's the driver because they're independent contractors, at least that's what Uber argues. They argue in some litigation that they shouldn't be, but that's a whole other issue. Don't they have an oversight responsibility? It isn't like they should be sitting back there saying, maybe some guy from MIT and Stanford will do a study to which we'll respond. I mean, isn't that a reasonable expectation the public should have, that companies that put independent contractors out on the road are looking to see what their behavior is like vis-a-vis the customer?
Yeah, I would agree with that. They certainly should take a proactive role in trying to reduce discrimination. And to their credit, both Uber and Lyft have reached out to us and want to hold meetings to think of ways that they can reduce discrimination.
Did you go so far, you or your colleagues, to say whether this significant evidence of racial discrimination is intentional or not, or do you not know that?
Well, so one thing that we wanted to do to get at that was to look at the race of the driver as well.
Yeah, wondered about that. Yeah. Does it matter if the driver's black or white?
So whenever you do a randomized controlled experiment like this, you have to go through a board on campus to get approval. And they actually didn't allow us to collect the data. Because one of their tenets is to not do harm on research participants. And they worried that some backlash could come to the drivers. We would like to at least potentially work with Uber and Lyft to dive deeper into the data.
You know, I wondered if it depended where the person was that was calling you, because you've heard for decades in the taxi industry, which is why we have gypsy cabs, that taxi drivers don't want to go into in Boston, say, you know, the toughest sections of Roxbury or the toughest sections of Mattapan. Did that factor in? I mean, if you were Caroline in Grove Hall, could you get a taxi versus if you were, Rashid in Beacon Hill?
So we did look at that. Now, we're a little spread thin on data in terms of the experiment, But it's actually the opposite of what your intuition is.
Really?
Again, we're pushing the data a little hard, but the biggest effects were African-American sounding names in low population dense areas. And our thought process there So our thought process is the driver self-selects into neighborhoods that he or she wants to service. And potentially, if they're in Lexington and they see an African-American sounding name, they might respond with, whoa, I wasn't expecting that. I'm going to wait for the next ride.
You know, we're talking to Chris Knittle from MIT. Do you have any sense in other work you've done about whether or not this pattern, for lack of a better expression, of racial discrimination is particularly bad in disruptors? Because I'm thinking about Boston. We all lived through the Amazon thing six months ago or something.
Airbnb.
Amazon overnight service was delivering every single community in greater Boston. But, oh, my God, what a coincidence. Three zip codes in Roxbury it wasn't. Now, to their credit, when they were outed, I think within a week, they fixed it. But they fixed it because they were caught. I don't think they fixed it because they had some great epiphany. Is there a record of disruptors often run by younger people being less sensitive to these issues than more established businesses, or is it across the board kind of thing?
Well, I think it's across the board. One thing I'll mention is that in our Seattle experiment, we actually had our research assistants hail traditional cabs as well.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were a white research assistant, the first cab passed you 20% of the time. If you were black, it passed you 60% of the
60?
Time.
60?
Yeah.
So, well, haven't you heard that for years and years and years?
Yeah.
I mean, that's been going on for forever. You hear stories here, you hear stories in New York. And that's why with the story about Dudley Square in Boston, all the gypsy cabs were lined up. And one of the guys there was quoted in the story saying, everybody I know is white, takes Uber. Everybody I know is black, does gypsy cabs. And you see the same thing in New York. If you go like to the Bronx or something, there's no cabs. You got to get the gypsy cabs there, too.
And that's actually one thing that we would love to look at with Uber and Lyft's data, which is where do these drivers choose to serve?
Yeah.
And that's probably might be the biggest effect in terms of discrimination.
So when Uber called you on the phone, did they call to yell at you or did they call to say, we want you to help us fix ourselves?
They called to ask us to help us
Great.
Fix ourselves.
So what do you recommend so that they don't continue to run afoul of their... And they go out of their way. I mean, remember when they were against fingerprinting during the regulatory hearings on Beacon Hill, the big fight they had with Commissioner Evans, who's here every month, their position was we can't fingerprint because it's going to discriminate against people of color because they're more likely to have a minor criminal record. And Evans, of course, responds by saying, when we do fingerprinting on taxicab drivers, we don't rule them out because of minor offenses. But in any case, what's the fix you propose?
Well, one fix, it might be a little too extreme, would be to get rid of names altogether. So you can just be 457 and you replace names with codes and you confirm your driver. They have a code. You have a code.
Yeah, but the problem with that, it seems to me, my initial reaction when I think I read something like that in one of these pieces was, let's assume that this is racism on the part of the driver. I mean, I know you don't know enough to know right now. We know that the effect is racially discriminatory. Does a black person... number five, want a driver who's racist picking them up? I mean,
that's a tension for sure. And it gets at some of the same issues with gay couples and cakes and things like that. I think for many of us, when it's raining outside and you have to get to the airport, you'll drive with anybody. But
So what else? I interrupt you. Beyond
another, they could be more proactive with cancellations. So they do have rules. They pointed out that drivers can't cancel more than 20%, I think. But that's within the numbers that we find. So we find that the African Americans are canceled about 12% and whites are canceled about 6%. So you could still be discriminating and under that
What's
threshold.
The reason for cancel? What's the common reason for cancellation? I have a closer ride or
might be a closer ride or what we find is the name is.
Uh-huh. But what do they say is the I mean, for those who say we're not racially discriminating, what's the rationale for a cancellation ever?
Sometimes they say it's based on where the passenger wants to go.
I see.
You might not want to go all the way to the airport.
I got it.
Or you might have found a closer ride too.
You know, Chris Knittle, one of the things I read is that there's a difference, a gender difference on who spends more time in the back of the cars, women. What's that about?
So we didn't design the experiment to look at this, but we had the data, so we certainly did. And what we found in Boston, at least, is women are driven longer distances and longer times compared to men. One of our research assistants, for example, said she noticed going through the same intersection four times.
I shouldn't laugh. That is horrible.
Right.
That is horrible.
Am I to assume this means that the drivers think women are too stupid to know where they're going? Is this what it's about?
Well, so I also have a colleague who will remain nameless who's told me that she's been asked out on dates three times while driving on Uber and Lyft. So we don't know whether it's a social phenomenon or if it's about fares.
Okay. I love that one. Can we ask some other questions?
Yeah, since you're an energy economist.
Yeah, we're going to take advantage
of your... We have some energy questions.
He went to MIT, so he's really smart. Right?
I went to MIT?
No, he did.
Oh, okay, fine. So he is real smart.
I didn't go to MIT, but I teach there.
Where'd you go?
I went to Berkeley.
Oh, then we don't want to ask any questions.
Then, if that's teach at MIT, then that's
well, can I start this? Because we're going to have a talker about this later. I am daylight savings time obsessed.
Okay.
Obsessed. Ed Markey, when he was a lowly member of Congress before he became a United States Senator, you probably know this, filed the bill, I don't know, 6-7 years ago that moved it up. That was a great advance in my estimation. One of the worst things ever is going to happen, I think, this weekend or whatever it is. What is it called? Eastern Standard Time? I don't even know what it is. But you dump daylight savings time, which essentially means you get out of work after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's pitch dark outside. Maybe that's a bit of an exaggeration. I was going to say my research. I shouldn't be saying it to a person like you. My reading suggests for health reasons, for environmental reasons, for virtually every reason, staying on daylight saving time would be a good thing in 2016. We're not in an agricultural society anymore. Am I right or am I wrong?
I agree with you. I could tell you what the evidence is, certainly on energy consumption.
Well, please.
It has no impact on net energy consumption. All it does is it moves it when you turn the lights on. So you turn the lights on more once we go to standard time in the afternoon compared to the morning. So there's no impact on that. People have looked at traffic accidents. Traffic accidents tend to spike right after changes. So if you could avoid changes, that would be a good thing. It's often pitched as an energy bill, but it isn't.
So is there a move in your world to deal with this thing? I mean, or is it sort of just...
Researchers have certainly put it out there and suggested that there's no reason I'm with you. I'd rather stay on daylight savings time.
Well, it's enough for me.
You know, before we get to the gantries, I do have a couple of good emails about the Uber situation.
Oh, please do. Yep.
Yeah, this is from Brian. He wants to know, he says that every time an Uber driver refuses a pickup, it eventually decreases the amount of rides he's assigned. So he's suspicious of your study because he said dropping these people would affect the driver negatively when a driver cancels or refuses.
Well, dropping the passenger affects him negatively because they no longer have a passenger. So look, there's a long history of discrimination where you're hurting yourself by discriminating.
Okay, here's one more. This is about, he says he drives for both Uber and Lyft. He doesn't like to get stuck in traffic away from surging, so I self-select out of areas that have a lot of traffic and no surging. Is that factored in? You're doing something different, though.
We do how you would test a blood pressure drug. We do an actual randomized control trial. All the RAs took the same exact routes, and we just randomized the race.
Okay.
We're talking to Chris Knittel from MIT, and the reason he's originally here is because he and his colleagues were the ones that did the study you read about in the paper, saw on TV or heard on the radio, about significant evidence of racial discrimination in Boston and Seattle vis-a-vis black people of color who were customers versus white ones.
Pardon me?
Oh, yeah. I'm just summarizing why he's here.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So can we talk to you about these gantries now on the Massachusetts Turnpike?
Sure.
As you know, we're going to get rid of the toll takers, get rid of the toll booths. I guess they're in the process of deconstructing them now. And by the way, the reports of massive messes on the Mass Turnpike
have not happened. I know.
No, they haven't.
By the way, have you gone through any of them yet? Of either of you? It is last night I drove through the Alston, Brighton, Cambridge thing.
What was there?
It's like a ghost. I mean, the structure is still there, even though it's beginning to come down. But it's almost like a ghost town kind of thing.
Yeah.
When you've spent your whole adult life seeing a human being peering out of one of the two little
were people still
hostage
in line at the cash thing waiting for the toll ticket to appear, or they
no, they were not.
Out?
But in any case, I interrupt you. It's very strange.
So a lot of people, we talked about this with listeners this week, and a lot of people are very suspicious of these gantries. One of the big suspicions is that not just that they're going to know where you're going, they're going to know your life story and your bank account and all that kind of stuff, but people are going to be checked for speeding going through these gantries, and that eventually that's how they're going to nail speeders on the Massachusetts Turnpike. What do people in your world think about these kinds of mechanisms? They open toll, no tolls, we can go faster, but you know, you're being watched.
Well, that's so it's certainly possible that they could use it to calculate your average speed between point A and point B. I'll say, going to the environmental side, there's been excellent work that shows that those sorts of toll collecting places create lots of pollution, local pollution, and there's
the
a
old
nice
ones.
The old ones.
The old ones. Yes.
Yeah. So there's a nice paper out of Princeton that shows infant health is actually negatively impacted in and around those sorts of tolls. So
wow.
From that
wait a minute, the infants in the cars or the
no,
infants
the
who live
infants
near
that
there?
Live near there.
Really?
Yes. So from that perspective, because that's you're inefficiently using that engine, you're creating congestion. There's lots of reasons that carbon monoxide goes up, particulate matter goes up. So from that perspective, I'm in favor of reducing the pollution.
Huh. But what about the whole, what could they find out about you going through there?
Well, we have cell phones. There's lots of people finding out lots of things about us. I'm not sure if that battle will ever be won, but I realize that it's a governmental agency that's
yeah.
now collecting the data. But it's certainly the case. They could calculate average speed between two points.
Okay.
You know, Chris Kendall, last thing for me on the and we're talking to Chris Kendall from MIT, who's an energy economist. The T. Marjorie's obsessed with it. The governor's obsessed with it. He's basically said, I'm going to fix this thing. And we all know that what sparked it were the incredible mess in February and March of a couple of winters ago. I assume people like you are pro mass transit, right? Because that's obviously good for the environment and energy consumption.
It's one
yes?
of the lowest costing ways to reduce CO2 emissions.
So if the public in Boston believe that the T was reliable and safe, they didn't read that there were 5 or 7 derailments of the Green Line, the highest apparently of any light rail system in the United States last year, would usage go up? Is there a correlation between that? Are we, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, for sure. There's a long literature showing that more attractive public transportation is the more usage. Even when gas prices go up, we see in the data people switch from driving their car into the T. So anything,
even small ones. I mean, we raised the gas tax here a couple of years ago. The embarrassment, in my estimation, is the tax-phobic legislature, the worst of both worlds. I'm going to raise taxes, but I'm going to raise them so little that it has virtually no impact, but enough so that I raise taxes. I'm going to take crap anyway. So you say if you're doing 3 cents, you might as well do 13 cents and actually begin to fix the problem. But do small increases actually change behavior as well?
It does, but
not as much.
Proportional to the change.
Okay, I have one last thing.
Wait, I'm not done with the tea.
Oh, okay.
Are you done with the tea or are you not
done
with the tea?
I was going to move on for the tea.
Oh,
actually.
You go ahead. Go ahead.
One last thing, and I'm just kind of picking on you because you're for, you know, you're an energy and environmental policy guy and you're at MIT, but I figure you kind of know what you're talking about over there. We have a presidential race now. We have a woman, Hillary Clinton, who does believe that climate change is real. We have Donald Trump, who thinks climate change is a big hoax. I worry a lot about climate.
Manufactured by China,
right,
by the way.
That's right. I'm very worried about climate change. So I wonder if in your community over there at MIT, since there are vast swaths, it's not just Donald Trump, there's a lot of politicians, millions of Americans who think this is a giant hoax, who think that we're not responsible for any of this. If there's a lot of talk of how you get people to face, which I think is the reality, that you know the Back Bay could be underwater, Cape Cod could be shrinking, not to mention what's happening in Greenland.
Well, the vast majority of people do believe that. It isn't like it's a 51-49 split.
A lot of Republicans, Jim, do not believe it. This is a
the
very
chair
partisan
of the
thing.
Science and Technology I know. Committee doesn't.
Yes, exactly. So
Inhofe, is that what we're talking about?
Yes,
yeah, from Oklahoma.
And millions of people do not believe it in the United States of America, and there's significant numbers of them in the Republican side. Well, anyway, is there something that you ever talk about or think about to kind of say, you know, to help people realize that this is real and we're going to do something dramatic?
It's just about our entire day is spent thinking about those sorts of issues. I gave a talk to MIT alumni organization once where I try to create, you know, anger among them. I basically said, well, look, these politicians are questioning what you do. and what MIT is about. MIT is about science and technology, and there's a clear consensus among scientists that climate change is real, and humans have a big part of that. It is – economics is called the dismal science. This is the most dismal part of being an energy economist.
Am I not wrong, though? I don't mean to put you in a tough spot, but since I just thought of it, I will anyway. When Marjorie Egan used to debate pretty regularly a former colleague of ours, Michael Graham, on our old radio station about climate change – he would always cite one denier from MIT. Was there not a really high-profile denier at MIT? Am I wrong about that?
There is. I've never met him. I think he might be emeriti. The only thing I'll say is that I've also heard that he denies that smoking is linked to cancer.
Oh, my goodness.
Well,
I won't be taking
sign.
His class. If that's,
that's a bad sign.
Chris,
well,
it's really good
success,
to meet you. Thanks
I
so much
for
your time.
Thanks for having
Thank
me.
You very much for coming in. Christopher Knittel is a co-author of a new study about ride-sharing and racial discrimination. He's a William Barton Rogers Professor of Energy Economics at the Sloan School of Management and the director of the Center for Energy and Environmental Policy Research at MIT. Christopher Knittel, thank you so much for joining us. Coming up, what does the election look like through the eyes of a foreign journalist? We're going to talk to a German reporter who's been covering the race for months, the presidential race that is, and we'll find out. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. There's no denying that as a nation, America is pretty self-absorbed. I mean, one of our presidential candidates couldn't even name one foreign leader he admired. But as a nation, are we self-aware? If we can recognize this election as a freak show of epic proportions, what must it look like to the rest of the world? Joining us on the line is someone who may not speak for the rest of the world, but he can speak for Germany. Matthias Kolb is a German reporter covering this race for, now, wish me luck, Süddeutsche Zeitung. I hope that's right. He'll tell me if it isn't. We checked in with him in March when the primaries were in full swing. Matthias, it's good to talk to you again.
Thanks for having me back on the show. And you came pretty close. We in Germany, we say Süddeutsche Zeitung.
That's what I meant to say, Matthias. Yes, exactly. Good to talk to you again.
Okay, you think he was bad. Wait to hear me at the end of this. At the end of this thing. Matthias, so great to talk to you again. And I do wonder, I mean, here we are in a situation, you know, with Anthony Weiner and his, you know, the investigation into his sexting, and Donald Trump with his talking about women, and Bill Clinton on the side with all his women, and everybody's hating everybody else. What do people in your country think about this election in the United States?
I think freak show is really something that would be a good way to describe it. I think it really has been a roller coaster for us foreign reporters to cover it, and I think also for the foreign audiences. I think it was really hard to understand how someone like Donald Trump can come close to gain the nomination in the first place, and then finally wind up being nominated back in Cleveland, also with this very, very dark message, this very gloomy, pessimistic view of America. I think that was also something that surprised a lot of people in Europe, just like how can you be so successful by running such a dark campaign? And I think over the summer, we were everybody was a little bit relieved. People felt like, oh, he was not going to make it. We had all the insults against the family of the dead soldier Carr, and then part of the Goldstar family, stuff like that. So I think people were relieved when they went on to summer vacation and said, like, okay, just like Hillary gonna make it. We can live with her. She's someone we know. She's someone who's closer to our values. Just like she doesn't vilify government like some Republicans are doing. But I think since September, it really was like this roller coaster ride. Like, I think all the whole discussion about fitness, the way Donald Trump talked about Hillary's stamina, stuff like this, those very sexist tones. These remarks sound very striking, I think, especially to Germans, where we have been governed by a woman for 11 years, and I think most would agree in a pretty okay way. So, yes, and then, of course, like you mentioned, October, we had like this big news about the tax declarations that he didn't make public, but then, of course, this huge sum, over $900 million that he made a loss of 95.
Yes.
And afterwards, he bragged about just saying not paying taxes. And then, of course, all their the lewd remarks that he made in the Billy Bush tape and stuff like that. I think it was just very, very nasty. And I think it also kind of fulfilled or made stronger some of their anti-American sentiments, or like the anti-American sentiments, or this anti-American feeling that some people still have in Europe, just like thinking like, oh, America, everything is just like way too superficial. It's all just about a show. It's not sophisticated. It's just way too much. And of course, over the last week, when we had to go back to Anthony Weiner and Huma Abedin and texting, trying to explain to my readers who these folks are, what kind of connections do they have to the Clintons, and of course with the polls getting closer, I get more messages on Facebook or emails just like, okay, like please tell me that he's not going to make it, that he's not going to make it, just like. But I try. I'm still convinced that Hillary will win in the end. But it was a ride.
We're talking to Matthias Kolb, who is depressing us more than we were depressed before we contacted him on the phone. But Matthias, is there not a large swath of the German population who's concerned about the large number of refugees that Germany has taken in, more than anybody else, what, in the range of a million, I think it is, who love the notion of a wall? I don't mean necessarily literally, but at least figuratively support the direction of that piece of the Trump campaign. Am I not right about that?
I mean, there's for sure, there's kind of like this new party that has emerged and became stronger over the last 2 years. Alternative for Deutschland is a name, and they are just like, they are similar to the Trump phenomenon in that sense. But they are popular among the people who feel like that they haven't been heard over the last years, that they feel all the other parties in Germany, that they are mainstream, they are all consensus, they are they don't listen to the John Doe, to the ordinary guy. So of course Trump has a certain appeal to these voters just by him being the outsider and being the guy kind of like who challenges the elites and the media. We get a lot of criticism as being too elitist as well in Germany as journalists. But I think still, I mean, the latest polls that I've seen, of course, it's tricky to poll Germans about the American election. He's still in the single digits there. I think people might like his appeal of being like the outsider and trying to shake things up. But I think his remarks, his manner, his style, his outright lies, his willingness not really to prepare to that office. I think that's also something that offsets like a lot of Europeans or a lot of Germans, even if they might like part of his message. I think they feel like he would just not be suitable to be the president of the United States. And of course, if you're the president of the United States, you bear a lot of responsibility for the rest of the world as well.
We're talking to Matthias Kolb, a German reporter who is covering the U.S. election. And you covered the election in 2012 too, did you not, Matthias, here?
Yes, I did.
You know, you mentioned a funny story about being in a Trump rally when Trump was talking about Germany being on the brink of revolution. Tell us of what he said and your reaction.
I mean, I think I've been to two or three events when he was just again mentioning that the thousands and thousands of Germans are leaving the country, and of course it feels weird when you hear something that's just not true being said by a major political candidate, and people are cheering. I think he didn't speak so much about Germany in the last weeks, but what I have experienced a lot over the last week while I was traveling across the country, I was in I think half a dozen states to cover the debates and to see what's happening on the swing states. I mean, the issue comes up a lot. I feel like a lot of Trump supporters or Republicans really want to talk. They want to talk about Brexit. And they want to find out if it's true that Germany is kind of on the brink of collapse, or whether we have a lot of problems there. And I always try to tell them that, of course, it's not an easy thing. It's not a Sunday walk. It's a huge challenge for us to cope over the next years, but that it's just not true that the country's on the brink of collapse. We don't have a crime rates going up. We don't have more, I don't know, sexual assaults, something like that. So I always try to tell them it's just one part of the story that is reported on Fox News every other night. And usually people are pretty like, oh, that sounds interesting. I wasn't aware of that. So that's an interesting experience. I've talked with a lot of Trump supporters, and in most cases, they are friendly people. So that's also something what I try to do in my reporting, to kind of like counterbalance this idea that everyone who votes for Trump is an outright racist and hates all the Latinos and is anti-gay and whatsoever. In my conversations, I feel that most of them are not racist, but they feel that the country is on the wrong track. They don't like the way the system is going. They feel neglected. It's just this guy with the blonde hair who is the messenger, and that's why they're following him.
Matthias Kolb, Marjorie and I have not spent as much time in Europe as we would have liked to, but every time one of us goes there, we come back and say, we cannot believe how intimate and deep the knowledge of most Western Europeans is about American politics, and how shallow, if not non-existent, our knowledge about anything else going on beyond our borders is. Does that not strike you regularly? I mean, is that not something is in your consciousness all the time? That's a fair picture, is it not?
Yes, I think it's pretty fair. I mean, of course, I think what you guys are doing, I mean, like the whole NPR network all over the country, I think you do a lot of great reporting from all over the world. So I often end up, I don't know, sitting somewhere in Indiana talking with someone who has a good knowledge about European politics, and then they say, like, oh, I listen to Indiana Public Radio in that instance. So I think you can get the information there if you really want to. But of course, I think, yeah, it's true. I think we have, just because, I mean, we have like 28 states all over Europe. I mean, I grew up in Munich in the south of Germany, so I'm kind of known. I'm used to, I don't know, go on vacation to Italy or to Austria or to France, just like going to a different country. And of course, you travel, you see the differences, you feel you should be interested in what's happening on the other part of the border. But I think my experience this year, 2016, and traveling a lot, I mean, the United States is just like a continent on its own. You just speak one language and pretend to be a country with 320 million people. But of course, I mean, the differences between Arizona and Nevada, where I was, I think, 2 weeks ago, and Terre Haute, Indiana, and St. Louis, where I was a week before, of course, it's striking just from looking at the scenery, at the landscape. One part is very white, the other part is super Latino. So I think that's just like also one of the reasons that the country is just so big. And there's so much going on all the time, and national politics and the World Series and all the other stuff. Yes, that there's not much time left to think about the rest of the world. But of course, I think the reason why we are talking, I think there are dozens and dozens of German reporters out there covering the election in America, just because we are so obsessed with America to a certain degree. The election that you guys are doing, I mean, it's like 1.5 years. We do only 5 or 6 weeks in Germany. So of course, there's a huge entertainment factor and curiosity factor for us as well in covering the campaign.
5 or 6 weeks.
Yeah, Matthias, which is incredible. Yeah.
Well, we're jealous. How does a new, candidate who is new, how does he or she get, I mean, I'd like a shorter campaign too. 5 or 6 weeks is amazing. How does a new person on the scene raise his or her profile fast enough to be able to have a chance of breaking through?
I mean, I think that's also just like the big thing. I mean, we rarely have new candidates there. I mean, it's all organized by the parties. The parties pick their candidates, and usually it's the front runner. So there's no, of course, Angela Merkel's popularity has been going down a little bit, but there's no real challenger for her. So she will be next year. She will be probably on the ballot for the fourth time. There's no real challenger. The Social Democrats, her coalition partner, they're kind of like trying to figure out who will be their candidate, who has to go into that hard battle to fight her. But it would be one of the ministers. That's also something I think what makes American politics so attractive to the outsiders, that a lot of German politicians have been around really for decades, for 2 or 3 decades. They've been all around. People know them, kind of like them, think of them as more like a teacher, office holder type. We don't have like these political entrepreneurs. We don't have a Donald Trump or even someone like Ted Cruz who just gets into office, decides I want to run, raises millions and billions, and just runs for it. Just our political system doesn't work that way. You would have to create your own party. It's just a lot of minutiae and boring work within the organization that does happen very, very rarely. So I think before this Alternative for Deutschland party, this kind of right-wing populist party that we talked about before, the other new political player that came up was the Green Party, and that was like 30 years ago. So it's very, very stable. It's much more about the political parties and not so hyper-personalized how it is here with you. So I think that's also something what makes it so exciting. I mean, just like a primary with 17 candidates, it sounds like paradise and like a nightmare. Paradise for a reporter and a nightmare for someone who longs for detail and policy and minutiae and stuff like that.
Well, you know, you just talked, Matthias, and it's so true that we are a huge country and very, very different. The East Coast, West Coast, very different than a lot, the middle of the country, I think, and the cities, very, very different than the rural areas. What kind of you talked about Americans being angry, and you talked about the inequality here and stuff. How surprising is this, do you think, these revelations about the anger here and about this vast inequality, the billionaire class, the Donald Trumps of the world, and the vast poverty in America? How surprising is that to people at home? I mean, the old cliche about us used to be, oh, you know,
yeah,
it was a big meritocracy, everybody can rise to the top, American dream, et cetera. And I think a lot of what has frustrated the Trump voters is that the American dream seems to have died for a lot of people.
I reported a lot in 2012 about the Citizen United decision, about the growing inequality, about the aftermath of the Occupy movement and stuff like that. And I think, I covered American politics for 5 years, and I feel I've always written about the growing inequality, about the huge differences between the rich and the poor, and that only rich people can, that it's so much easier to enter politics if you are a millionaire before, and stuff like that. But I feel I wrote about it, and it was interesting for German readers. I got a lot of feedback, but it was probably a little bit like, okay, that's just like the way it is. They opted to organize politics that way. And I think what was really striking in the beginning, or like about 1 year ago in fall 2015, when I started to cover the first Bernie Sanders event and the first Trump event, starting to realize that there is really something is changing. People are really angry at both political parties, at the elites. Of course, the anger was a little bit stronger on the Republican side, I feel, just because they felt our leaders just overpromised and they didn't deliver. And I think some of the most interesting stories that I did was just like traveling to rural Pennsylvania or parts of Ohio and trying to talk with people and do some stories about how people live from paycheck to paycheck, how hard it is to make ends meet, to get insurance, how crazily expensive it is to send kids to college. I think that's one of the reasons, one of the issues that Germans really can't understand at all. I mean, we still have free public universities pretty much. So I think with all the reporting, it's just made sense that people are angry and that people want change and people don't like the two-party system anymore. So I think that's a part of the 2016 stories that a lot of Europeans understand. I think they just don't really understand why exactly Donald Trump is the messenger or is the guy who runs in front, and there are millions and millions who are willing to follow him. But of course, I think that's the job that we as journalists being based in the U.S. have to do, just to describe that level of inequality and that level of poverty that is acceptable among Americans. And I think it's not really acceptable among Western Europe. I mean, Western Europeans. I think if I have friends who visit me in D.C. or when we travel to New York, I think you meet so many homeless people, you see so many homeless people, you see so much poverty all over the place, and that's just striking and just doesn't fit into their shiny, glamorous picture,
yeah.
That Hollywood movies and TV shows and everything portray. So I think there's empathy, there's sympathy, there's understanding that people feel left alone and not being heard about, and that also Democrats have left their blue-collar workers pretty much alone, or have taken them for granted and thought that Silicon Valley is more interesting and sexier, and the new economy and Uber sounds way more interesting than unionized stuff. But I think they're paying the price, and that would be for someone like me, who's like more like from the nerd or policy wonk side. I think that would be super interesting over just like what will happen starting, one week ahead after the election, just to see how both political parties deal with the aftermath, because I think the Democrats also have a lot of, let's say, homework to do, and then have to find a way how to bring in their the crappy voters who would have loved to have Bernie, who want more social justice, who want a more left politics. So that will be super interesting to follow.
Matthias, it's great to talk to you yet again. Thank you so much for your time. We hope to talk to you again soon.
Matthias, you're going to help me out here. Tell me the name of your newspaper, please.
It's Süddeutsche Zeitung.
That's what I was going to say. Thank you.
Very much. And it's a pleasure to talk to you, Matthias. Matthias Kolb is a German newspaper reporter. He just told us the name of his newspaper, and we much appreciate his taking the time to join us. Okay, coming up, we're turning back the clocks, getting an extra hour of sleep. Jim is beside himself. We're losing an hour of light. Is it worth it? We're asking you next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. This weekend, we're turning back the clock, not all the way back to 2008, unfortunately, just an hour for daylight savings, meaning the end of it. And as we do every year, we ask you, is it worth it? Should we get rid of it? Should we make this a ballot initiative? Or should we keep this convention of switching things up twice a year in the name of productivity and energy conservation and fewer car accidents? Where are you on this switch? 877-301-8970. We talked to an energy economist a few minutes ago from the Sloan School at MIT. He's with me. It is ridiculous. Enough all this already. It is a throwback. And I'll tell you, I know the energy issue, and he says there's no energy savings and all this thing. When you switch time, there are more accidents. We should keep it. But the part that is most significant, the darkness is a – I don't have seasonal affective disorder. I know a lot of people do.
Yep.
But I don't have a condition as such,
mm-hmm.
I don't even know where you are on this. Tell me you are not depressed, even if not clinically so, when you leave work. You leave here at 2:30,
let's say,
3 o'clock.
That's right.
It's going to be dark when you leave work starting next Monday or dark soon thereafter.
No, let's not exaggerate too much. It'll be dark about 4 o'clock.
Oh, that's great.
It's bad.
So where are you on this? I'm going to see how aggravated I'm going to get.
What about the tiny tots, Jim, waiting for the school bus in the dark?
It is totally incredibly ridiculous. The only thing I've heard, which, by the way, is for one day, mm-hmm. is what? You get an extra hour of sleep and you fall back, right?
I know, isn't
one
that great?
Time.
This Saturday night, Jim,
one time.
When you may need it because it's going to be 3 days before the election, you can go wild. Stay up till all hours, watch every last second of Saturday Night Live, and you can sleep an hour later.
Okay,
Saturday
so
morning.
You're doing this just to aggravate me, right? Because I assume you think we should stay with daylight saving time, right?
Jim, I...
You don't care?
It's not one of those issues that I can get.
You don't hate the extra darkness. You don't. That doesn't trouble you. In the middle of the afternoon.
Well, I find the whole season from December, January, and February
is
pretty depressing.
Is cold better if it's lighter or darker? Which is better?
I don't like being cold. I don't care if it's dark or light.
Oh my God, hopeless. 877-301-8970. My sense is, I mentioned this to Chris Kanittle an hour, a half, or whatever it was ago. Ed Markey did a great thing for America when he was a member of the House of Representatives. He moved up the beginning of daylight savings time. I think it's saving, not savings. What, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, something like this.
Yeah, we would have already been in it.
I don't know. What do you mean?
He made it later.
He made it earlier. He made the beginning of daylight saving time and the end of this nightmare that's going to start Sunday.
It ends sooner. The time of darkness is shorter.
That's exactly the important thing.
We would have already been dark at 4:30.
But he hasn't finished the job.
To finish the job
is to get rid of this fallback crap that we're going to endure this weekend. And I know Marjorie well enough to know she's just baiting me. I'm the kind of person who could be baited with a tweet. When it comes to this issue. I don't know who said that, but I'm saying that right now.
You're a man who could get outraged about many things at one time. You're a multi-outraged.
Can I tell you something?
What?
I know I have a lot of projects, and I know I have a lot of mandates.
I thought you were going to say you have a lot of problems.
In the minds of some. I would have to say this may be in my top 10. I know it's not.
Really?
Yeah, this is really aggravating to me because it is so obvious to me what the solution should be and is.
Yeah.
That it's
I thought banning toboggans was on your top 10.
That's my top 15. They're dangerous. They're dangerous in urban areas, and you know them to be dangerous.
And we should wear helmets in our cars.
They should. Little kids should wear helmets in cars. That is correct. I'm not saying it should be mandated. If it isn't done voluntarily, maybe we need to mandate it.
Okay.
877-301-8970. If people bait me on this, I'm going to get aggravated during this discussion, too, because I really care a lot about this.
Yeah.
You take the calls. I don't even want to take
okay.
the calls.
Okay. Let's start with Terry in Boston. Hi, Terry.
Hello, Terry.
Hi. Good morning. I'm a daily listener. Marjorie, I just want to take a minute to say how amazing you are. The only reason I ever read the Herald was when you were there.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm
Your
not there. Thank you.
Some people think I'm amazing too, Terry. I want to make that clear. Much smaller swath of the population. But
thank you, Terry.
Terry, thanks for the call. What's up? What do you think about this switch?
Actually, Jim, for something new and different, I agree with you today.
Oh, yes.
I absolutely agree with you. I think the cold is tough enough and seems endless. I always say February is the only month with 28 days, it feels like 52.
It's a good line. It's true.
To add the darkness and just have it be literally pitch black at 4 o'clock in the afternoon and cold and windy, it's depressing. Nobody wants to go out. Nobody wants to do anything. They just want to get home and get into PJs as quickly as possible. And it's not necessary because the original reason, as I understand it, were because children shouldn't be standing out in the dark for the bus. And I've never seen a child in, I don't know, 10 years standing alone doing anything.
Excellent point.
And the other thing was for the farmers. And I think that's obsolete. So I don't know the point, and I don't know why some states have eliminated that and we can't, or what's involved with doing that.
That was a brilliant call from beginning to end. Thank you so much for the call. It's like sadism on the part of elected officials.
You're getting a lot of support on this, Jim.
Well, it's such a common sense position.
Nick just emailed, for the first time in a month. I wish he said months. I wish he said years. I find myself agreeing with Jim Browdy. Get rid of daylight savings. I can't stand the sun going down at 3:45 in the afternoon.
It's not get rid of daylight saving. We're in daylight saving. We want to keep daylight saving.
Okay,
we're going to do the fallback thing. But
okay.
I know what they mean.
Eve emailed. Was it Eve that emailed that it was Richard Nixon who started this? Did you know that?
I don't know who it was. I don't know who it was.
I did not know that.
You know who did a great piece on this, which we should have? Edgar, and as in the Curiosity Desk. Edgar B. Hur III did a wonderful piece on this.
He did a wonderful
piece. But I don't care what the facts are, frankly. I mean, in the history is. What I care about is today in 2016, most of our listeners are not farming. And most of them... Some are, by the way. We have callers who work on farms.
We do.
But I think they could deal with it. And I think, as that woman, was it Terry just called, said, very few little toddlers are placed out on the sidewalk by themselves in the dark waiting for the school bus. Their guardian, their mother, their father, their somebody, some adult or an older sibling is standing with them. So that argument is from the bygone era.
Waking up in the dark. Does that bother you?
Not as much. I don't like it. I don't like darkness at all.
Yeah.
I mean, darkness is
Sweden,
sort of.
Jim.
There's a romantic
Norway.
Thing. In summer, darkness is actually quite wonderful when it's hot. But when it's not hot, there's nothing to recommend it. Let's go to Steve in Rochester. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hey, Steve.
Hey, everybody.
Hi.
So, interestingly, a couple years ago, as we were getting ready to switch over the times, either in the fall or the spring, I was curious as to why we're still doing this nonsense. So I looked around, and there's actually a pretty thick, a couple hundred-page book about daylight saving time.
Yeah.
And it turns out that you could have put that into a three-page pamphlet.
What's the gist of it? I'm probably not going to read the whole thing.
You know what? I don't even remember.
Perfect.
But it started with some silliness that some European guy would like to get up early and ride his horse, and it irritated him that nobody else was up. So he figured maybe everybody ought to move their clocks around.
So wait, that's what you got from all 200 pages?
That's what I'm telling you. It was a complete waste of $19. Whatever they filled this couple hundred pages with, you could have just saved the paper and written it.
You're with me on this.
You know what? Personally, I don't mind daylight saving time. What irritates me more is, and I had this argument with my kids at the dinner table the other day, is that everybody puts an S at the end of savings, and that's actually
drives me nuts too.
I know. I just did it, Steve. I can't help myself. I apologize. You are correct. It is daylight saving, not daylight savings. But thank you for the call, Steve. Let's go to Bob in Arlington. Hi, Bob.
Jimmy. Remember who used to say that to you all the time?
My mother?
No, was it Chris Collins?
Oh, actually, Chris Collins.
Yes, he was
my former NCN colleague. He did do that, too. Drove me nuts. Yeah. Go ahead.
Three-word solution for you, Jim. Coal miner's helmet.
Yeah, I know.
You don't have that one in your collection yet.
No, but by the way, that's what kids can do in the morning. That's a solution. If we buy in. Oh, but, so you're with me.
But I am so with you, Jim. I was saying to the
coal
lady
screener,
who went to the phone.
Colleague, producer.
On a day like today, let's say it was dark already this week instead of next week. Beautiful day like yesterday and today. I love sitting out in my patio, reading a book in the afternoon, and I got to get up and go in because it's dark out. It's the worst invention since, unsliced bread. It's ridiculous. It makes absolutely no sense. And if it was Nixon, that answers a lot of questions.
Bob, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
Robert just pointed out that there are states that don't do the clock change. It just stays the same way.
There are fewer.
Which is a point I'd forgotten,
but
too.
But I don't care. I don't live in those states.
I know, but apparently maybe Arizona.
Arizona,
just said
that's
he grew up in Arizona where it's not done. It's far better. The insurance companies have shown. Well, Hawaii, I mean, that's a whole different world.
Well, yes, I'm telling you, Hawaii.
Out there, isn't it? It would be neat to live in one of these places. I wouldn't want to live in, like, Norway where it's only, where it stays dark forever. But there are places like England where it's really light, till 11 o'clock
at night.
Take
to get to the studio every day? It'd be ridiculous. I mean, seriously, even if it's light. So late. By the way, I do like summer night and a beautiful summer
night.
In July
when it's light till 8:30,
but also the
nine.
Darkness is great when it finally comes late at night. But this 4 in the afternoon thing, what's the worst? Like four something?
I think it's December 21st or 22nd.
And it's 4:10 or something?
That gives you a little lilt in your step when you realize the days are getting longer.
I know,
December
from that moment, that's true.
From that
I know.
Moment, then you can
and
look
also,
forward.
Because you start saying to yourself, it's only a month till the tea stops for a month or two. So that's also a really heartening thing.
This is what I think a lot of people experience this. We talk about being stressed out about this election. Ever since that horrible winter of 2 years ago, when it was just a nightmare and you had those 8-foot piles of snow and your whole porch was covered with snow and stuff like that, I think a lot of people are having post-traumatic stress about wintertime. Winter never bothered me that much. Now I live in fear of another winter like that. When the previous call said all you want to do is get home and get in your pajamas, it's true. I mean, that whole winter, all you want to do is get home and get in your pajamas.
But unfortunately, you couldn't get home. That was part of the problem.
Well, even your snowshoes. I mean, you had to pile up.
Do you remember those photographs of people marching, like the death march on the side of the subway cars when they were stopped down?
Keolis, whatever you call it. The
commuter rail. Yeah.
The commuter rail. The people were trudging. The snow was up to their thighs. It was like looking at the Russia and the Gulag in the 1920s or something. It was unbelievable. And the best thing was, I've said this before, but why not say it again?
Say it again.
Because I live next to a school, and there's a lot of traffic on the street in the morning. No one shoveled the whole sidewalk. They shoveled like an 18-inch path through these big, huge snowbanks. So if you ran into someone on the street, you always decide, were you going to go chest to chest or were you going to go butt to butt?
How about people in wheelchairs are totally screwed
in
those kinds of
things?
I know. It's horrible. More in North Attleboro. You're next on Boston Public Radio. We're talking about keeping daylight saving time year-round. Otherwise, it ends this Sunday, November 6th at 2 a.m., which is painful. Go ahead, Maura.
I had an idea. I think we should just shorten everybody's work day by 2 hours during this November through February.
That's right.
And then on the other end of it, lengthen everybody's work day by 2 hours. So you still make the same in a year, but you just it'll work out better daylight.
You're a bit of a genius, actually, Maura. If we don't change the, if we continue to change the time thing as an interim measure, isn't that brilliant, Marjorie, or no?
Yeah, although I must admit, I kind of like getting up in the dark because it makes me feel more industrious.
What do you mean by
makes
that?
Me feel like I'm
really... Oh, because
really,
you're like charging into the night kind of thing?
Well, no, getting up in the dark. Mm-hmm. You know, the dark when I get up because I feel like that makes me a better person because I'm getting to work early, you know, right away. You know what I mean,
or Jim? Going to the dentist on the wrong day, which you did last week, which sort of part of your repertoire. Remember when you went to the wrong, not only, a couple of years ago, I think we were at the other radio station, it was one thing. Marjorie literally last week went to the dentist on the wrong day, which has happened many a time. That's sort of bad. Several years ago, Marjorie not only went to the dentist on the wrong day, she went to the wrong dentist.
I went to the wrong
dentist.
Is that
a true story? Is that not a true story?
Well, you know, I was traumatized by my dentist.
I know.
Well,
let's not get into that story.
Okay. Kelly from Marshfield.
Go ahead, Kelly.
How are you guys today?
We're excellent. Thank you.
Oh, this is so exciting. I listen to you guys every day.
Thank you.
But yeah, I am. So I work with horses on a horse farm down in Marshfield.
Yeah.
Ooh, neat.
And to be honest, I want to just get rid of daylight savings time completely, like, because it affects myself and the horses. And, you know, when we're bringing them in, I'm handling like 1,500 pound animals and I can't see like walking in front of me.
Wait a minute. How does it affect the horses? Do they get a little freaked out, or is it just the darkness and leading them?
Well, I mean, they're animals, so they, you know, they are affected because every day is the same routine for
True.
Them. And yeah. also, like, the horses just in general, even though the heat is, like, pretty hard on them in the summer, most of them absolutely hate the winter, so they're also not very happy when it gets cold out. And myself, like, I get out of work, you know, we wrap up here around 5:30, and, you know, I can't, like, even bring my dog to the park after work because it's pitch black.
Amen. Kelly, I am so with you. We are bonding through this horse talk here. I am so with you. That's a great point, by the way. You are a big dog person. Do you like walking the dog in the pitch black?
Well, you know, I must
mid-afternoon,
say, I
Kelly,
was thinking,
thanks for the call.
Yesterday, I checked what time the sun was going to set, which was about 5:30.
Do you really do that?
Well, because I want to take the dog for the walk up the Boston College Reservoir because it's really
nice.
Pretty and the
pretty,
leaves
yeah.
are all different colors
really
and stuff.
Nice, yeah.
So I made sure I got there like by 5:00 so that, you know, we'd have the sun setting over the water, Jim.
Wow.
And the trees and the colors. And it was a very romantic moment for me and Harry the Pea, best dog from C2C.
He's a beautiful little thing. Donna in Plimpton, you're, I think, last of this round of calls on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call, Donna. Hi, what's up?
Good morning.
Yeah.
Jim, I am so with you.
Thank you.
I am so tired of this stuff with daylight saving. It doesn't do anybody any good.
Nope.
Anyway. And I think some of the most important things are being overlooked. People with mental illnesses are affected by anything.
Yep.
And when the time changes, then the time for the medications change. Their sleep, the circadian rhythm is off. They don't get the sleep they need because they wake up and they have to get up earlier, especially if they're in a home or
Donna, do you know, can I interrupt you? There are negative health consequences for otherwise perfectly healthy people because of
That's
the chime
right.
changes, because it changes all your rhythms. There are more accidents.
Exactly.
We talked to Chris Knittel about this. So the switching, you know, by the way, as much as I hate the darkness, it'd be better for society, even though I don't like what we're about to do on November 6th, if we did that, if we kept even that year-round rather than doing the switch. But I prefer keeping daylight saving time.
Well, I think the question is, before we move
Donna,
on here,
thanks.
Jim, what should be done about this? I think the first thing that should be done is this should rise to the list of your crusade list. I think you should put this ahead of banning toboggans and wearing helmets in cars.
I did, by the way, the banning toboggan I put on hold for a couple of years. I decided I fought the good fight on banning urban toboggans was my position.
Oh, okay.
I wasn't against rural. If you're out in the country or wherever people do tobogganing, I just don't like it in cities.
Okay,
that's it.
But we should do something about this.
Governor's going to be with us at the end of the month. The states can do this individually. We should really push the governor hard on this.
Okay.
I'm going to need your help.
All right, we're moving on. Coming up, we're going to talk to the former sheriff of Suffolk County, Andrea Cabral. Fatal shootings of police officers are up more than 50% from last year, and we had a tragic situation involving a mentally ill man shot by police in Boston. We're going to talk to her about that as well. Former Sheriff Andrew Cabral, up next, 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I am Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Is that correct? Yes.
That is correct.
She is. FBI Director James Comey has a new critic, the teen, I didn't know this till today, who allegedly received the sexting from Anthony Weiner, has written an open letter to Comey, calling him her newest abuser and accusing Comey of reopening old wounds without warning. Here with us in Studio 3 for a take on this and also some local things that are really serious. Is Andrea Cabral. Andrea, of course, is the former Suffolk County Sheriff and the former Secretary of Public Safety. Andrea, it's nice to see you.
Hello, Andrea Cabral.
Are you election stressed?
I'm still laughing over the fact that you were going on and on about daylight saving time. I just think that's
Wait a second. Excuse me a second. You're a former whatever, like a law enforcement type.
Yeah, former whatever is what I had in my yearbook.
Is it not better for public safety for it to be? I didn't think of this. Isn't it better if it be lighter for what you used to do
that's
for a living?
That's not the point, Jim, she's making, I don't think.
I know what her point
so
is.
So many
people
outrages.
People really don't time their crimes so much anymore to light or dark.
They say, oh, I'll do it after November 6th
right,
when daylight
right,
saving.
Right, right.
Okay,
that's
forget
right.
that. I'm sorry I asked.
Okay, Andrea Cabral is on the team Hillary Clinton, so I'm sure you're not very happy with the FBI director. But there's a new twist, as Jim just mentioned, in this case, that there is this 15-year-old girl that Anthony Weiner was texting, and this is she is, and the fact that she's underage is what the FBI had been investigating when they came across this text. But she mentioned in this piece, like Jim, I just read today, that Comey talked about this case. He talked about this sexting case. She had just been interviewed for 7 hours right. by the FBI.
Right.
Nobody gave her a heads up that she was going to be kind of outed. And then her whole street is covered
right.
with reporters, and the reporters are calling her on the phone.
Right.
As I've said before, I have, because of the Whitey Bulger case and some other cases, I've had my problems with the FBI, but... Boy, don't you think of the victim?
Well, clearly I'm a Hillary Clinton supporter, but my outrage over what Comey did has much more to do with my background as in law enforcement. Just everything.
You know him,
that,
by the way? You don't know him, do you?
No. Never met him. But what he did was clearly without precedent. It just doesn't.
The
you just
email
don't,
thing or the victim thing?
The press conference okay. in July, sending the letter, the fact that this letter goes out, and as you say, this young girl has just had to go through having this conversation with the FBI for seven hours, right? And the next thing she knows, reporters who, you know, were looking for someone to sort of jangle the keys, the next shiny thing, that was the jangling of the keys, and they rushed to our house, and she's only 16 now.
Yeah.
It's outrageous. I thought the letter was beautifully written. I mean, she was very clear and very candid about how she feels, but a very mature 16-year-old in terms of her ability to express herself. But it is outrageous, and it goes to the single-mindedness in getting that letter, supposedly within less than 24 hours after he learned that a laptop they'd had since October 3rd might have Huma Abedin's emails on it. The rush to get that there, so much so that not only did he not go to the public integrity section to say, look, we're not supposed to be giving Congress or anybody a heads up on investigations. I'm kind of thinking I need to do this. What's your advice? Which is the prudent thing to do if you're going to try to violate a policy. Get some advice on it first. Not only did he not do that, but nobody bothered to even ask about this girl. Like, what do we? Is this something we need to tell her? Because it's pretty much guaranteed that the minute this letter hits, Jason Chaffetz is going to tweet it, and they're going to be talking about it. And
he's the head of the House Oversight
right.
Committee, who has said, by the way, and even if you're a Trump fan, when Chaffetz said a week ago
right.
that if Clinton is president, he already has 2 years of hearings
right.
lined up into the Clinton administration, to me is unconscionable. And again, that has nothing to do with advocacy for or against Hillary Clinton. If she wins, she's the new president. Work with her. If she loses, it's just...
Well, we know you're not advocating for her.
I don't advocate for everybody, unlike
Marjorie.
No, but
you're absolutely right. The idea that they're saying things like, you know, we're going to impeach her starting day one. A, I can't imagine that would ever happen with a male president. It just wouldn't happen with a male president. But two, they're elected to govern. They're elected to get things done on behalf of the people. And essentially they're saying, we're going to spend your tax money to further our personal political vendetta. It's amazing. But this young girl, I felt so much for her when I read that letter
yeah.
because I cannot imagine what it's like to be descended upon and have people camping out She's sick, and you know, it's the other thing is reporters. She's 16. Leave her alone.
Well, yeah, you know, it is interesting because typically you don't go after children, and that's now she's 16. She's not a child, but she is a teenager, and this is sort of a sex thing.
Right.
So I don't know. The whole thing is very queasy, and she talked about her own lousy self-esteem issues, et cetera. So it was a sad situation.
Have you seen Wiener, by the way? Have you seen the documentary?
No, I can't bring myself to watch it because I can't look at him for that period of time.
Well, you know, Frank Phillips was here from the Globe the other day and said something like, you know, is the epitaph on this election going to be that it was determined by Anthony Weiner and Billy Bush? Or Billy? It is horrifying. As far as I'm concerned, Weiner cannot go far enough away. But in any case.
Let's move on to this case of Terrence Coleman. People may remember Terrence Coleman, 31-year-old, a black man from the South End with a history of mental illness problems. His mother said he was sitting on the stoop for 2 days and wouldn't come in, and she was concerned it was getting cold, called the EMTs. And the EMTs arrive, and some sort of fracas ensues, and police officers come in, and the police say that that Coleman was going after the EMTs with a knife, and the mother says that there was no knife and that her son was killed needlessly by the cops. There was a vigil last night with people asking for basically the arrests and prosecutions of these police officers. There's an investigation going on, but so far Police Commissioner Evans has supported his officers. The EMT story seems to support the officers, but the family insists that this is not how it happened. Needless to say, this is another reason why cameras on police officers would be a good idea. But what's your take on how this will proceed?
Well, we start from the perspective that a mother called to have her son taken to the hospital.
Right.
And he wound up dead. So there is no amount of scrutiny on that that would be undeserved. Right. Now, the story said that the police over the last 10 years had been called to the home. They said about a dozen times. For various things, and the ones that were mentioned involved him being perhaps a danger to himself. He had a pocket knife several years ago, and he had cut himself with it, and so his mother called. But beyond what the content or the nature of the calls were, this is clearly someone who has a documented history where she has explained from the very first time to the current time that he is a schizophrenic and that he has mental health issues. So the first thing I thought when I read it was, this is yet another example, and there are infinite numbers of them, that, you know, she didn't call the police to her home. She called for EMS and the police accompanied them. Now, whether or not the police accompanied them because somebody looked it up in the computer and said, oh, we've been to this address before, that young man has mental health issues. The person you need to have there is a social worker or someone with a background in psychiatry who can talk this person, which he actually has a right not to go to the hospital.
Right.
But if the mother really felt like he needed to be observed, maybe talk him into going. Someone who was going to calm the situation down versus escalate it. And the mother said at one point, one of the EMTs raised her voice to him and he became more agitated. I'm just always stunned and floored by the notion that in case after case, there can be one person, even if you accept that he had picked up a knife. And I don't find that there's anything particularly conclusive that really it warrants. That's a central part of the investigation. There are four people there. I assume that the two police officers were male. Maybe one was female. Maybe both were female. Maybe I'm wrong about that, the EMS people. But there were people there. And the inability to subdue someone and do something less than lethal, it just floors me every single time that it's death after death after death. And it seems to happen more with some than with others, and I don't understand it. And it infuriates me and it frustrates me.
You know, in July, the Globe did a spotlight series on the 65 fatal shootings in Massachusetts by police over 11 years. And their conclusion, which is obviously the relevant point here, roughly 50% of them involved the victim was someone with some serious
mental illness.
Mental illness. You know, Commissioner, long before this happened, I would, maybe not every month, but pretty regularly. Commissioner Evans is in here every month, but not every month does he bring it up. He's brought up in the context of other shootings how much they focus on training about how to deal with people on mental with mental illness. Is your experience that the average cop, I don't mean just in Boston, anywhere in Massachusetts, has the kind of training they need to deal with what is obviously an incredibly difficult and sensitive kind of situation with people who do have mental illness?
Overall, I would say, and I don't know if things have changed since I left government, but overall, I would say no. I think that there's a significant disparity in both the quantity and the quality of training, and it depends entirely on whether or not, you know, the Boston police are almost pretty much self-contained unit.
Mm-hmm.
They have their own budget. They can put their budget toward the things that they prioritize. Most, we have 351 cities and towns, many of them small towns and small cities with strapped budgets. And so they are, sending their police officers to initial cadet training, recruit training, and then in some in-service if they can afford it. They can't always afford it. This is an issue that we worked on a lot when I was secretary and constantly were asking for appropriate funds to appropriately, you know, train people regularly. Not only do you get, it's not just the initial training you get when you're joining the force, you have to be trained yearly.
Yeah.
And that yearly training, that curriculum has to be looked at over and over again and updated to the kinds of things that address the issues that police officers are facing. But, you know, there is certainly training that police officers can have that help them better understand people who are mentally ill and give them some tools to sort of de-escalate situations. But it's not a bad thing for police departments to have access to mental health professionals. And here's the issue with this particular case, because whether there's a, you know, some sort of wrongful death lawsuit or not, the question is going to come up in the investigation is that if you brought police with you when the EMTs went, did you know or have reason to know that you were dealing with someone with mental health issues? And once you knew or had reason to know that, were the steps that you took appropriate to minimize harm to that person? Because if you go there knowing they have mental health issues, then a potential sudden escalation is even more likely. And so I think that's what so you got to drill down and kind of think about this.
That's a great solution, though, in some ways, is to have a mental health expert. Because I know
there are some police
social workers
that,
go out on a call they think might be dangerous if they're taking a child from someone and they're worried. They bring the cops, you know, for their protection, everybody's protection. This seems like it would be...
There are police departments that do hire, and there may even be one or two in Massachusetts. I could swear I read an article recently, and I'm not sure. I don't think it was... Why am I thinking it was Revere? I'm not sure if it was Revere, but there was... I read recently, and it was a local newspaper, that there were social workers being employed and or mental health workers being employed. Maybe somebody will call in and let you know. If they have one of those departments. And it does make a huge difference, in much the same way as having victim witness advocates at police stations makes a difference in how the police department, if not individual police officers, but the department as an entity, responds to the needs of victims on scene in a way that doesn't alienate them or frighten them.
I want to return to what Marjorie mentioned in passing when she was asking her first question. I mentioned this on Greater Boston last night. The commissioner was here, I don't know, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and we asked him what the state of the pilot program, the 100 cameras pilot program. He says all positive, nothing negative. The officers are not complaining at all, except some technical things, but not about wearing them. We've gotten some evidence, particularly, I think he said, in drug cases will be useful. But he literally ended by saying all positive, no negative. There are some cost-benefit issues. We asked Marty Walsh about this on Friday when we had him with us on the library. Are you supportive? Yes, I am, but there are cost-benefit issues. My contention, I think Marjorie's, is this is the end of the debate. I mean, these guys were in a district where these, I don't know if they're guys, these police officers were in a district where cameras were assigned, but they were not assigned to them, which is fine because there are only 100 in the pilot. It's quite clear that having cameras on these officers would likely have resolved the dispute between the mother of Terrence Coleman and the police. Is that not the case?
Yes,
unless you have
so.
The out. Isn't there an out where someone could say they don't want to have the cameras on? I mean, the mother could say.
I think that's if it's a domestic. I'm not sure what the rules of the road are. There's a domestic violence situation or something like that. But the reality is the likelihood would increase dramatically that you'd have some record. Yeah. Of what went on here. By the way, to make the story even worse, and you agree with that, yes?
Yes.
Okay. I'm just curious. The thing that makes the story even worse, not that losing a life, particularly of someone who suffers from mental
31.
Illness, is horrible. There were five grandchildren
right,
in the house, including a five-year-old.
Right.
While this was, and that's not to, I have no idea where the truth lies. We'll find out, hopefully, after D.A. Conley does his investigation. But it makes right. something horrible.
And it said nothing about him
more.
Having a history of violence. It did say that he had a pocket knife and had cut himself, which is harm to self and harm to others are you know, two different things. And usually people are assessed for both. But it's very unfortunate. And it's, you know, but, you know, we say that every single time it happens and it keeps happening.
You know, I gave you the statistics from the Globe Spotlight report. And we're talking to Andrew Curbell, former sheriff of Suffolk County, former secretary of public safety, about, you know, of the roughly 50% of the 65 police shootings that ended up in fatalities over the last 11 years, according to the Globe Spotlight team, were of people with some level of mental illness. With the two cops that were killed in Iowa yesterday, that brings to 51 and 52 this year, fatal shootings of police officers are up 50%. I know that in Dallas, after that most horrific of where five cops were killed, the number of police officers resigning went up dramatically. In your experience, both as a former DA and then obviously head of public safety here, doesn't that make it so much harder to get a young man or woman who was contemplating doing this job to do the job as dedicated as he or she is when they know how much more cops are targets in 2016?
Well, a couple of things with that. And before I get into the substance of your question, the man who shot the two or ambushed and killed the two cops in Iowa was described as sort of this. The word actually used in the coverage was radicalized, sort of white supremacist guy. Right, he was thrown out of a high school football game for standing in front of a crowd of black students waving a Confederate flag. And Renee Graham from the Globe had this amazing tweet, which was, "Really, did anybody ask where he was radicalized?" And I just thought it was perfect because we won't ask that question. And that case didn't get anywhere near as much coverage as if the man had been yelling slogans favorable to ISIS before he did it.
Right.
And that's a shame because that actual threat, when you look at the threat that ISIS poses to individual people on a daily basis and the threat of domestic terrorism,
or if you were
particularly
black,
from white supremacist militant groups, is much higher.
When I heard it, I thought if this was a black guy that shot these two police officers, that would have been a huge issue in the campaign.
Right. Right. I think it would have been. But two things, you know, the violence actually toward police officers under Obama is at an all time low, much lower than the previous administrations, whether it was Bush 1, Bush 2, Reagan, all of them. So
fatal shootings are up, though. Fatal shootings are up.
Right. But in part. They are up because we've had some mass shootings where several cops die at the same time. I don't think that it has that great an impact if people want to become police officers. I mean, it's an inherently dangerous profession. They wouldn't let you walk around with a gun if it wasn't. So I think that people who really want to do it will still do it. It's not that it won't cross people's minds, but I think people who want to become police officers and want to be in law enforcement usually really sort of passionately want to do that. It's not something where they're saying, I could either do this or become an accountant, you know?
You know, the whole, we only have a couple minutes left, the whole relationship between police and communities, sort of analogous to this mess of a presidential election, it is so intense and out of control. Do you read the story about the wife of this Milbury cop?
Oh, God, yes.
Milbury is in Massachusetts.
Yes,
who contends that there was a break-in and vandalism at their home, which is, you know, that's one thing. And that what, Black Lives Matter or BLM, I don't know if it was the initials or Black Lives Matter, is what, spray painted or scribbled on the back of the house?
Scrawled.
Which is obviously a pretty dramatic, scary kind of thing. The only problem with it is the home wasn't vandalized, there was no robbery, and there was no BLM put out by outsiders. It was by her.
Right.
I mean,
well, you know what? I actually disagree with you that that exemplifies the poor relationship between community and police. I mean, it certainly doesn't help. But the notion that you can commit a crime and be halfway to getting away with it if you blame a person of color is longstanding. Charles Stewart,
oh,
Susan
yeah.
Smith. I mean, this we have a huge, any one of a number of alleged rapes and unwanted sexual contact that were false that led to lynchings and beatings and killings in the South. That's a historic tactic.
But to the credit of the Millbury police chief, he apparently didn't believe this for a second and a half.
Yes. Now, when you look at the coverage, if you look at the Washington Post coverage of the story, it does say that he didn't believe it. And it said that when it was turned out that it was a lie, it said the police chief was vindicated. And I was thinking, really, what about Black Lives Matter? They've kind of been vindicated, too. But what he also said was that he drew no inference from the fact that this wife of a police officer wrote BLM on the side of the house. And I'm sorry, that's disingenuous. And how do you know it's disingenuous? Because on her Facebook post, which she posted after this vandalism happened, and she said it was a terrible thing to know that they had been at home while they were being robbed, asleep in their beds, and that there was such hatred for police officers. She knew exactly what she was doing. And like I said, you can be halfway to getting away with it because, as we've discussed many times and many studies have shown, people are more inclined to believe that you know, and I don't know if Black Lives Matter.
That if a black person is accused,
exactly.
It's more likely they are guilty than
absolutely.
If a white person.
Well,
does.
Wasn't this cop a canine officer?
Yeah.
With the canine dog in the house.
That was part of the reason that the chief.
Yeah.
Thought she
so
was
you
lying.
Would assume that if your master and his wife are asleep and it's
right.
the middle of the night and you're the canine dog, which is usually like German Shepherds
right.
or you know or some kind of dog that's trained.
Well, what kind of person do you have to be to say we're in financial trouble and the way we're going to get out of this and collect some insurance money that we're not entitled to is not just by saying that we were robbed and we weren't because
yeah.
you could certainly people have set the stage you know stage the scene to look like a robbery, but we're going to go the extra step to make it more possible that we don't get caught by blaming a group that is in the minds of many people representative in some ways
yeah.
of an entire race of people. There's something to that. And like I said, people repeat behavior that works. And that has worked a lot in the past. And I don't think people have gotten caught doing it anywhere near as many times as they've actually done it.
All right, Andrew Gabral, thank you very
Thanks.
Much.
Hey, Andrew, I was going to call you. If Tuesday doesn't work out, Marjorie's going to need a support group. So if you can call her maybe 11 o'clock on Tuesday night and see if you two can get
well,
together.
Well, you won't have to worry about daylight saving time because it's always dark in the dystopia.
But I'm bummed. Thank
yeah.
you. Andrew Gabral.
Andrew Gabral joins us every week.
She'll win by 7.
Thank
okay.
you very much. She said she'll win by 7.
Win by 7. That was her prediction. I'm
Great
writing that down, Jim.
Andrew Gabral, yes.
She's the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety. Andrea, thank you very much. Up next, we're going to talk with Congressman Joe Kennedy. We're going to talk to him about this race and a bunch of other stuff. The congressman is next. Joe Kennedy, stay tuned. Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie. And last time Congressman Joe Kennedy was here, Marjorie asked him if working out at the congressional gym helped in any way to ease bipartisan tensions. Who knew that it wasn't going to be crunches but Comey who would unite Democrats and some Republicans. Congressman Kennedy joins us in Studio 3. Talk about this and a range of other issues. Congressman, it's great to see you.
Great to be here. Thanks for the opportunity.
And by the way, we don't have a huge amount of time, but Congressman said he's happy to take calls. If you want to make it, you can be in touch with him directly at 877-301-8970.
And Congressman Kennedy, a lot of people are very worried about the race. Psychiatrists and social workers and therapists are saying that 52% of America is like a nervous wreck over this. On both sides, the Republicans and the Democrats, Andrew Gabral, who is a Hillary Clinton supporter, she just predicted a +7 race by Hillary Clinton. You are, of course, a Democrat. I know you're with Hillary Clinton. Do you want to make any predictions here before we continue, or you want to talk about your state of nervousness?
My prediction is going to be that she wins by 50 points. I have been...
I have been wrong on most of the predictions I've made over the course of this of this campaign. So if she only wins by 49, I'll still be wrong, but okay. I'll still be excited.
Are you nervous?
Anderson, well, answer the nervous question, and then I'll...
Look, I think, Marjorie, yeah, of course I'm nervous. I'm confident, but I'm also nervous. Look, I think there's a lot at stake in this election, like there are for many elections. But I think, you know, candidly, you know, I have great confidence in the ability and competence of Secretary Clinton. I've got serious concerns about the temperament and judgment of her opponent. And I think that, you know, more so than any race that I can remember. Obviously, look, talking about prior races here, my politics didn't necessarily line up with Governor Romney or John McCain or others. I don't doubt the fact that Governor Romney has certainly the temperament and qualities and intelligence and composure to handle the pressures of that office. We just disagreed politically. He wasn't unfit for it. I don't have that same confidence with Donald Trump. And so am I nervous? Yeah, I am nervous. But that does mean that I think all of us over the course of the next five or so days, whatever it is at this point, have a chance to do something about it. And you make those phone calls, you knock on those doors, you engage people in that discussion, you go out and vote, as I already have, and you do what you can. So,
you know, Congressman Kennedy, I've read comments you've made about you're unhappy with FBI Director Comey, but you seem to echo what at least Hillary Clinton was saying immediately after Friday, John Podesta, her campaign chair, give us everything you got kind of thing. Does that mean today that if the work that his agents are doing leads him to some conclusion in the next 5 days, would you urge him to broadcast that conclusion?
I would urge him, Jim. Look, I think I think I shared the troubles with an awful lot of folks, as you indicated when we started, Democrats and Republicans, about Director Comey injecting himself into this race and the FBI into this race with such little time to go, particularly given the fact, as it's turned out after that letter was released, that not only had he not read them, not only had the FBI not read them, they hadn't even begun the legal process to obtain them at that point.
Right, they didn't get the warrant until Sunday.
They didn't get the warrant until the weekend. So I think that breeds the question of saying, if you're going to inject yourself in this, Secretary Clinton has called for just saying, look, lay it out there so that people aren't wondering what's going on, what's in there, aren't asking those questions. And look, the FBI, their job is investigations. The longstanding protocol is that you do not comment on as to whether or not investigation even exists. I don't want the director or anybody else to be giving us a play-by-play. What I do want them to do is finish this as quickly as they possibly can.
If they finish it by tomorrow. Alan Dershowitz said, yeah, he was with us earlier this morning, said, I'd love a statement making clear what he knows and doesn't know. And yes, he should do that. Should that pronouncement, if he can do that before Tuesday, happen?
I think the more clarity that we can get about what was in these emails, I think Secretary Clinton has called for him. I think that's the right thing to do, but not continuing a discussion as to, hey, here we are today and here we are tomorrow, and a running commentary or play-by-play on the investigation. That's not what the FBI should do. And this is, Jim, I think part of the challenge with all of this is, look, Director Comey has, over the course of his career, earned the respect of folks from Washington, Democrats and Republicans alike. It makes this decision to send that letter on Thursday all the more puzzling, given, again, what facts have come out since, that he declines to actually add the FBI onto the list of agencies that were
about the Russians.
Mm-hmm. He declined to continue to investigate. DOJ basically declined to continue to investigate or push forward an investigation on Paul Manafort and his ties to Russians in Ukraine, or Secretary Clinton and the Clinton Foundation, because it was so close to an election. So you have these protocols that are set up that have been applied in a bipartisan way that Comey has also followed to an extent and then didn't. And that's going to lead – he was undoubtedly in a tough spot, Jim, but that's going to lead people to question the integrity and of the FBI in that institution.
Was it bad judgment or was it politically motivated in your estimation?
I'm not really willing to call it politically motivated at this point, but I think the fact that he injected that conversation will lead people to ask that question. And I think at this point, it's a fair question. He has to expect that that's the question they're going to ask. And that's a problem not just for Democrats or Republicans. It's a problem for those that want to have faith in federal law enforcement, which again, Jim, is why you see that pushback coming from Senator Chuck Grassley, the Republican head of the Judiciary Committee, Jim Jordan, the head, the leader of the Freedom Caucus, the most conservative wing of the Republican Party, no fan of Hillary Clinton. He said it was an unfair thing to do. Joe Walsh, one of a former member of Congress who is one of the most outspoken conservative now talk show hosts in the country.
He's the one who said he's going to get a musket in a tweet.
And
by
he
the way,
said it was unfair to Hillary
if Clinton is elected. You know, you mentioned your colleagues. My obsession, and I, Marjorie thinks I'm obsessed with everything, but I am particularly obsessed with this. Let's assume your candidate wins. And the likelihood is that if the Democrats are lucky, they take over the Senate. The reality is they're going to pick up seats in the House. Paul Ryan's still going to be the Speaker of the House. Explain to me, and I don't mean rhetorically, like we're going to reach across the aisle. We're all going to be. How does Hillary Clinton govern this country in this kind of incredibly toxic environment with the state of the House being what it is?
Look, you got to go. You go piece by piece. You go issue by issue. You go person by person. And Jim, look, as we've talked about before, there are undoubtedly the issues that we fight against and fight about: healthcare reform, immigration, taxes, and others. And those are still going to be there. There's other issues that we have been able to kind of go a level beneath and actually reach across the aisle, find some good pieces of policy, and move those pieces forward. We've talked before about some of the bills we've done on manufacturing. A Revitalize American Manufacturing Innovation Act, a big manufacturing bill we got passed in our first term. One of those centers, the umbrella that is supported by our bill, is going to go into MIT. It's a $300 million project, $70 million of Defense Department money. We passed a bill out about a month ago. If for those folks out there that use those consumer websites like Yelp or TripAdvisor.
Oh, I love this one.
So people out there.
Well, explain what it is. People don't know.
So people that were using those websites, as I do all the time, they had started to put in these non-disparagement clauses. So there was a couple in Texas that hired some company to walk their dog. Didn't go so well. They posted a negative review. The company sued them for $1 million. There was another couple that a guy who stayed at a hotel posted a negative review. The hotel company charged his credit card $3,000, all because of fine print someplace was put someplace in the contract. That objectively is not the right thing to do. Leonard Lance, a Republican from New Jersey, and I worked together on the bill. It passed unanimously.
Yeah, but you know what the difference is, with all due respect, Congressman? Even though you're a Kennedy, and to a lot of people, Kennedy is, you know, this, you know, it's almost like the Antichrist to a lot of people. No, it is what it is. You are liked by your colleagues. I mean, that happens to be a fact. Hillary Clinton is incredibly polarized. This is not a criticism. This is a statement of fact. She is an incredibly polarizing figure in this country. 60% of people in the Washington Post ABC poll this weekend said they had an unfavorable opinion of her. Immediately, that was right after the Comey thing. She's not you. She is, I mean, why do you think that any Republican, other than a fair-minded one, some are going to say that's oxymoronic in the House of Representatives, but I know it isn't, with some, why is there going to be any cooperation? What's their incentive?
Jim, because I think there are, much like with the two bills that I just talked about, there's areas where the interests that I have and the interests of our Republican colleagues, they overlap. There's areas of interest that Secretary Clinton has where our Republican colleagues, they overlap. The obvious one out there to begin with is transportation funding and trying to leverage some of the money that is now kept overseas by multinational corporations, the so-called repatriation loophole, mm-hmm. to bring some of that money back and capitalize an investment in infrastructure. Is there a way we can do that? Yeah, there is. Does that align with some of the interests of our Republican colleagues? Yeah, it does. Why? Because there's infrastructure projects in their districts that also need to be funded.
But the Republicans didn't fully fund the six-year infrastructure authorization either, did they?
No, they did not. But there's – so, look, I think there's – Secretary Clinton, like her husband, knows, I think, how Washington works. It's why you will also hear my colleagues, as I'm sure you have heard, say that they didn't agree with Bill Clinton on a whole lot of things. But you know what? When you got behind closed doors, they actually say he was a great president and we can find a way to work with him.
We're
and I expect
to
hear the same thing about Hillary.
We're talking
number
to Congressman Joe Kennedy.
877-301-8970. If you'd like to talk to the congressman, he's going to be with us at the top of the hour. But before we get there, Jim mentioned this to me, and it was a great point that Anderson Cooper made last night on CNN, that you know, Hillary Clinton has gotten great support from her fellow Democrats. Barack Obama, he was unbelievable in North Carolina yesterday. I saw him on television giving a barn burner of a speech. His wife, Michelle, is very popular. Joe Biden, very popular. All these great surrogates. Trump does not have very many surrogates in his own party. And yet, the race is tightening. So what is this? There are millions of Americans who are very unhappy, and they're unhappy there were millions of Democrats who were unhappy because they voted for Bernie Sanders in the primaries, too, and had to be kind of coerced to come with Hillary Clinton. So what does that say? What are we missing in the United States?
Marjorie, it's a great point. Look, I've had the chance now over the past couple of years, obviously, in Congress. One of the real privileges of the job is that you get to go in when we are in session, you're with people from literally every corner of the country, right? Democrats, Republicans from rural Idaho and Oklahoma and Texas and Silicon Valley and Massachusetts. And you realize a couple of things. One, what is obvious to me isn't necessarily obvious to them. What's obvious to them isn't necessarily obvious to me. My priorities aren't necessarily reflective of their priorities. They represent different constituencies. But what we have seen over the course of this campaign, now 18 months or so, is a boiling up and a frustration from the right and from the left and from the middle, too, of just frustration saying our system isn't working for us. And we see that, I think, driving – that was a lot of the outsider campaign that pushed Donald Trump to the nomination. You see that in an excitement for Senator Sanders. You see that – I hear it all the time from people in the middle saying, I don't know where to go anymore as these grounds, political grounds, shift underneath them. I think we – as a society, and particularly the Democratic Party, have to recognize that frustration for an awful lot of folks comes from a very real place. And you got an economy, we've made some great gains of late, but you've got families out there that are still working really hard and struggling to get ahead. We've got a criminal justice system. I know you guys were just on with Andrew Cabral. Sheriff Cabral, who we've got on our criminal justice system today. If incarceration rates don't change, 1 in 3 black male babies born today can expect to go to prison over the course of their lifetime. We've got an education system. We've got 1 million public school students are homeless. We've got a mental health system. I've been doing a lot of work on trying to push some reforms on that. Where 80% of the kids, the children in need of mental health services in this country, do not get the help that they need. So when you see this frustration boil up and boil over from people saying, hey, this system isn't working for me, we have to acknowledge they're right. They've got a reason to gripe. What I would push people on is to say Donald Trump has not offered a solution to any of those concerns. Secretary Clinton has a lifetime of dedicating herself to trying to solve those solutions. That is also my charge as a member of the House, as an elected official, but also just as a concerned citizen to try to say, those challenges affect everybody, regardless of party or station or where you live or what party you're from.
You mentioned education. How are you voting on charter schools?
I'm a no on charter schools.
No?
No.
Why? Quickly.
Quickly. Look, we do have some great charter schools in Massachusetts, and I visited some of them. They're fantastic. However, the challenge that we have in our public education system is this ballot initiative going forward is not the silver bullet. What we've seen, I think, over the course of the debate on this question has been that while charter schools, some of them are great, it does, has brought to the fore some of the systemic challenges we still have, particularly when it comes to charters on funding, on accountability, on inclusion, and certainly, again, the funding mechanism on it. So I just don't think that this ballot question is the right way to go.
Will, you've been very patient. You're with the Congressman Joe Kennedy. Will in a car. Thank you. Welcome. Hi.
Hi, thank you for taking my call, Congressman. Basically, I was just trying to get a question in on the issues. I was a Bernie supporter in the primaries, so I want to know, assuming Secretary Clinton gets in, I wanted to know what you would be doing about money in politics and gerrymandering specifically, because those, I feel, are some of the biggest issues that people on my side feel when they say, the system isn't working for us.
Shoot. Will, thank you very much for the call. Congressman Kennedy.
Will, thanks for the call. You literally hit the two issues that if I could shake a magic wand, wave a magic wand, and solve two challenges in this country, it would be nonpartisan redistricting and campaign finance reform. And I think, look, Jim, the conversation we had to open this about some of the issues, taxation, immigration, healthcare reform, and others, the big seismic debates we need to have in our country, the reason why we're not having them is driven by those two issues. It is a gerrymandered House of Representatives in particular that has empowered folks on the far left and particularly just more so on the far right. We've seen those numbers reflected across the country, means that you have a larger stratification of political ideology empowered by campaign finance dollars to those extremes, and then folks asking for them to compromise. It's just too big a gulf to come together. There's progress we can make on both of them. One, there's various bills that Democrats have filed already about trying to even out the campaign finance playing field. So through additional disclosures, one. Two, through the empowerment of and creation of a public financing system so that members of Congress would focus more on small value donors rather than high value donors. It's a critically important piece to the actual process and system by which Congress functions. Obviously, the nonpartisan redistricting piece is a little bit tougher because that is done state by state. But, Will, what I think we really need to do is continue to make the case across the country as to why this is so important and why it is so critical. We've seen states, particularly like North Carolina, Florida, Virginia, a couple of others, where Democrats got wiped out, Pennsylvania, when we lost control of the House in the elections back in 2010, where Republicans gained so many state control of state legislatures that ended up wiping out, redrawing districts and wiping out Democratic congressional seats. North Carolina, I think, went from 7-6 to 10-3 in Republican favor. Florida, we saw something similar. Pennsylvania, we saw something similar. So just trying to get fairer lines drawn and then compete on ideas. Make sure that as members are going out there making a case, it's a question about values and vision and policy and not about how a district is drawn and what measures are used to suppress a vote rather than turn it out. And that's, I think, what we're seeing across the country in many respects today.
Yesterday, Joe Kennedy, we talked to Brian McGrory about the terrific spotlight series or piece done by Andrea Estes and her colleagues about this Thornton law firm, speaking of campaign finance stuff. Mm-hmm. And this it hasn't been declared illegal, but this notion you give a donation to a Democrat and then you get a, quote, bonus roughly equal to that. To me, it sounds illegal, has been found to be. You got money from them. Did you return it?
We're in the process thereof. Yes.
You are doing it.
Yes.
We are. Was there a delay or, I mean, did you decide to do it right away or you were what was your thought process
so,
about
look,
this?
Look, I know that law firm, and Mike Thornton is a friend. He's been a supporter of mine. I think, like everybody else, was unaware of the mechanisms here. I think it's important to know, Jim. One, at this point, they are only allegations. He certainly deserves to be able to make his case. And he had it, from my understanding, just reading those articles, that he did have outside counsel look at it and set up that system. So he deserves to be able to make that to make his case and to have his day and have that voice heard. I decided to return the money just out of an abundance of caution and trying to make sure that, at least from my perspective, to go make sure we're playing right down the middle in terms of campaign finance rules.
Even if it's not illegal, it smells pretty bad. Would you not agree?
It might. I don't know whether it's illegal or not. That's obviously for I think there's been a complaint filed for an investigation. Mike deserves to have, and that firm deserves to be able to have their voice heard on it. But it's certainly, the allegations are troubling, and I wanted to make sure that we sent the money back.
Judy in a car.
So we sent it just to specify. We sent it upon legal advice. We returned it to the Treasury.
Judy in a car, you're on Boston Public Radio with Congressman Joe Kennedy. Welcome.
Did you just call for Judy?
If you are Judy, that's who we called for. Hi, Judy.
I am Judy in the car.
Hi, Judy.
Greetings, Congressman. You're talking to one hell of a Democrat.
Judy, there you go.
I'm in my 70s. I became a Democrat from having an independent voice in my vote most of my life. I became a Democrat when the Republicans stonewalled this country. I said, I've always believed my voice made a difference, and it has in many other ways. I was certainly going to make sure that it made a difference when I voted. And if you'll excuse me, I'm about to tell them I want a medium hot French vanilla decaf.
Could you, Judy, could you get me a small dark with milk and no sugar?
A small dark.
No, I'm kidding. Okay, Judy, do you have a question?
On the phone.
Good. Do you have a question for the congressman?
So, a medium hot French vanilla cream only.
Oh, my God. Question for Joe Kennedy here?
Yeah. The timing on this is really bad. Okay, here's my comment.
Okay, go ahead, Judy.
I know that one person can make a difference, and I have demonstrated that since I was a teenager. I'm now 74. So my switching to a registered Democrat meant that I...
Judy, is there a question for the congressman? What is it?
The question is this. I am very much, very anxious to see more doors open to high school kids, because I live in the moment, but I look to the future. The millennials wanting to back away from being involved is only a result of our not having done a good job on them when they were.
What doors do you want open for high school students? And then the Congress
allowing high school students to have clubs within the school where they can assimilate by aggregate by parties. So if a Democrat representative or a Republican representative wants to come and tell them what's going on in Congress or ask for their support. just like other clubs, they could have political clubs.
Got it.
I didn't know they were.
Are they
outlawed.
Precluded? Are public schools, are they precluded? As far as you know,
as far as I don't know, I was actually. I mean, I just came from a high school. It was an AP government class, but in one of the high schools that I represent. And we've done a number of those high school stops over the course of the last couple of weeks before our campaign. We get invited to a bunch of high schools. Sometimes it is a Democratic club that does it. Sometimes,
yeah.
So the problem club is, hasn't invited me, but
I'm glad you got a coffee.
Yeah, and mine is going to be delivered in a minute.
We have a question online from Susan from Uxbridge. Yeah, who's
what
asking about a casino project and WRTA projects in Worcester are dumping contaminated soils into the small towns along the Blackstone River. I don't know if this is your district, Congressman.
Do you know about it?
But in any case,
Uxbridge is not my district.
Well, she's very concerned about the contamination. She says her
I think
kids,
it's Jim McGovern.
Yeah.
Is it not? Sorry. Hey, Congressman, my obsession of the day, well, several obsessions. One of them is we got to keep daylight
cameras
savings
in the courtroom.
Time. Yeah, well, cameras, I'm not even going to ask you again until you tell me you've come over totally to our side.
Just
and you're also poisoning the mind of Seth Moulton on this issue.
It's like appellate judges, Supreme Court, absolutely.
Okay, fine.
Trial court, we got a problem.
Daylight saving time.
Yes.
I don't want to get rid of it Sunday at 2 a.m. Can you do something about this or no?
Jim, I think, first off, a couple things. One,
I
waking up when it's still dark out is brutal, so I want to hurry that up. The only challenge I have with the timing of this one is it means this election cycle goes on for 1 hour more, which...
Off quadrennial years, you're open
just
to this.
Just speed it up.
Hey, have you read? I asked you this last time I saw you. One of the best books I've read all year was about your grandfather, Bobby Kennedy by Larry Todd. Have you read it?
I have not.
Why, if I may ask, why have you chosen not to read it?
Jim, I have. So I think the world of Larry Tye, I've gotten to know him.
He thinks the world of you, too, for what it's worth.
I think he's a great author. I've read some of his other books. Wrote a great book on Satchel Paige, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm a fan of his. My decision not to read the book is certainly not a reflection of the story. Everybody has told me it's a great book or of the author. Jim, there's been a lot of books written about my family over the years. Some of them have been portrayed them in a positive light, some of them not so much. What oftentimes those books miss is they capture the historical nature of who the impact that they might have had on our country. They might try to tell a little bit about who they are. These are also folks to me who are family. And reading another person's interpretation about who your grandfather was or, other family members is just, to be honest with you, not something that I'm going to cede to somebody else, however gracious or well-intentioned or diligent they are about painting an accurate portrait of that person. Folks, there's particularly for public figures, there's those public moments. There's also private ones. I've tried to absorb as many private ones as I can through my family, but that's the important part of who they
Fair
are.
Enough. By the way, the lines are totally full. Our apologies.
Yeah,
but we're
going to
do it with the congressman's permission. If you stay on hold, we will take your email or phone number in the congressman's office. We'll get back in touch with people if they had questions. Congressman, it's great to see you. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you very much for coming in. Congressman Joe Kennedy joins us in Studio 3, as you just did, from time to time. We're glad to have him. Thank you for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, we're going to be broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library. We're going to be with Rebecca Tracer, who's just written a fascinating book about single women. Alex Beam, our election theme news quiz, Elephants versus Donkeys, and, of course, Emily Rooney with her wild and crazy list. Our crew, Chelsea Murrs, Amanda McGowan, Tori Bedford, Jason Teresky, and Molly Boygon. Our engineer is John the Claw Parker. What's on TV, Jim?
A couple of things. I got a first time with Rebecca Tracer, All the Single Ladies, this terrific book about unmarried women, the growth in numbers, their impact on America. She's going to be with me tonight. We're obviously going to talk politics with 5 days to go. And Stephanie Lydon does a piece on the effort to regulate Airbnb on Beacon Hill. My favorite part is this is the only company in American history that asked to be taxed where the legislature said no. So we'll get into that a little bit tonight.
I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in tomorrow and have a great afternoon.